You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, stopping the F-35, our guest, James Mark Leese, is a Vermont attorney and a past co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild Free Palestine Subcommittee. He has been a leader of a campaign to block the stationing of F-35 jets in Burlington, Vermont, and of the formation of a Vermont chapter of World Beyond War. Jimmy Leese, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Jimmy, I try to avoid having anyone on this program more than once because there's so many great people to have on. But when you succeed at a project you were struggling at, then I invite you back on. And you have just had some success, correct?
We have. We've had some fantastic success. We still have some steps before us.
And what is the new success?
Well, we petitioned to get a referendum on the ballot in Burlington, Vermont. Burlington owns the local airport, the Burlington International Airport, and based at the airport right now are 18 F-16 fighter jets that are used frequently in the war in Iraq and in Syria and in Afghanistan. And the Air Force has announced that they're going to replace the F-16 jets with 18 F-35 jets. These are the new stealth bombers that are designed for first strike attack on other countries, and they're capable of carrying nuclear weapons and therefore ground attack. They're for dropping bombs on these other countries. And so the success was getting the petitioning to get on the ballot and then the campaign to win the vote. And on March 6th at town meeting day here in Vermont, Burlington voters overwhelmingly adopted the resolution to cancel the F-35 at the airport. We won with 55% of the vote, notwithstanding a huge campaign led by the Vermont Air National Guard. The resolution won in 6 of the 8 wards in the city, some of them with 75% of the vote.
And then the city council followed up on that public referendum, right?
That's right. Last Monday, the city council voted 9-3 to inconsistently with the ballot item. So we now have the city, both the voters and the city council, on record calling for replacing the F-16 with something other than the F-35, something that's low noise and a high safety record. So and hopefully something that will, I think the petitioners are hoping that it'll be some kind of an equipment that will not get Vermont involved in these foreign misadventures.
So the city council runs the city and owns the airport and has told the military it doesn't want the F-35s. Is that then a done deal, or can the military say, what do we care?
Right. Well, it isn't a done deal yet, because the mayor of Burlington still has announced that he might veto that resolution. And he's considering whether to sign it or veto. And we should get an answer by April 16th. So
everybody call the mayor?
So everybody needs to call the mayor and send emails to the mayor. And encourage him to listen to the people and follow the instruction. This comes right out of the Vermont Constitution, that the elected officials are the servants of the people, and the people get to instruct their public officials. And so we've gotten the instruction, and the city council included many people who otherwise supported F-35 basing at the airport, but they decided to listen to the voice of the people. And I do respect them for doing that.
And
we're hoping the mayor will also do that as well.
And is it helpful, Jimmy, is it helpful or hurtful for everyone outside of Burlington who cares about this to also call the mayor?
Everyone can call the mayor. And I think that...
phone number or where do people find it?
I have the phone number here. Let me... give me a second. I'll get that for you in a minute. But we can continue to talk.
Sure.
The next step is going to be, if this resolution is approved, to get resolutions approved in neighboring towns, including South Burlington and Winooski. These towns are way more affected by the basing of F-16 and F-35 jets than even Burlington is, because the aircraft take off from the airport and fly almost immediately right over the center of Winooski, located. It's a city with it's the most densely populated city in Vermont, it's located only 1 mile from the end of the runway.
And that includes over an elementary school where I came and spoke, right, where the damage will be done to the students at that school.
That's right. You were there. The elementary school, middle school, and high school are all located on one campus, and they're right in the flight path. And they're going to be getting an incredible increase in sound level when the F-35 comes, interrupting classes and having what the Air Force and the World Health Organization and the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, consider to be a totally unacceptable, and NATO has looked into this, and they've decided that this is something that's unacceptable. You're not to put military aircraft with such intense noise in a location where there are children and where there are schools.
And we should be clear to people, as you have explained previously on this program, that this is not just a question of annoyance, but of basic health and life, right?
Right. What the World Health Organization, they've reviewed 24 studies, medical studies that have concluded that it retards reading, it delays reading for children, it impairs concentration, memory, and attention. And these are the things you need if you want to be successful in school. So this is really a damaging thing to the mental development of children, and it's not allowed. And the other thing that it does is that it causes stress and damage to the vascular system in people and in animals. So you get this intense noise that's incredibly loud, and there's a reaction in the body, and it causes heart disease and strokes. And this is something that it begins at a young age. It's not just that you get it when you're old. It's something that has been created over time. And so we're going to be seeing these children having vascular impairment as they get older. And so what we're saying is be sensitive to the people, not just to the military and to the business community, which sees various ways of profiting from the basing of these military jets.
We're speaking with James Mark Lease, an attorney in Vermont who has been a leader in this campaign, and the City Council of Burlington, Vermont, has just voted along with the people's majority opinion to not have the F-35s in Burlington. This reversed, as I understand it, the City Council's vote of 5 years previous. What changed their minds? What were the steps that made this happen, that people in other cities where the F-35 and other disastrous equipment is planned can follow to reverse a city council's will?
Well, the key thing was the vote by the people. So here in Vermont, we have town meeting every year, every March. It's the first Tuesday in March. And so the voters get to initiate proposals for the vote. Here in Burlington, we had to collect the signatures of 1,800 voters to get the resolution up for a vote on the ballot. And that is actually a daunting job. Nobody expected we could do it because it's incredibly cold in January, and the deadline is towards the end of January. So we're petitioning in freezing cold, and it's really very difficult to do. It hasn't really been done by petitioners in Burlington, the largest city in Vermont, where it's the hardest to do in quite some time. And I recall back in 2005, we tried to petition to abolish or to end U.S. involvement in Iraq. And we weren't able to get enough signatures in Burlington. But at that time, the Burlington City Council agreed to put the resolution on the ballot. It said that the Burlington and its voters strongly support our men and women in the armed forces and believe the best way to support them is to bring them home now. And that resolution won with 65% of the vote, and it won in all the wards of the city. It was the most outstanding result. So we knew that if we try again with the F-35 resolution, we had a good chance of winning here in 2018, 13 years later.
Yeah.
This time, we had a huge campaign against the resolution by the business community and the Vermont National Guard. But they were not successful, and they didn't have the facts and arguments. They didn't have any way of countering or even addressing the issue of what's happening to thousands of families in the noise zone and in the crash zone of the F-35. It's a new plane. The crash issue is really, actually, if anything, more of a problem than the noise issue. This is a new plane with what the Air Force considers a high crash rate, a very high crash rate, as all of their new fighter jets have. And then it also has incredibly high consequences when it does crash, emitting toxic chemicals, fibers, and particulates that get into your lungs and never come out and cause all kinds of problems in your lungs. And carcinogens are something that we don't need anymore.
So we are hopeful that the mayor does not veto, and people need to tell him not to veto. But
let me give you the phone number now.
Yes, please.
It's 802-865-7272. And his name is Moreau Weinberger, Weinberger. And his email address is very short. It's mayor, mayor, at burlingtonvt. That's burlingtonvt.gov.
Feel
free to email and call the mayor and invite him to sign the resolution to cancel the F-35 and provide replacement equipment that will be low noise level and with a high safety record.
Jimmy, we will put that information on the website at talknationradio.org as well for anybody who didn't catch the phone number or the email address. It will be there, talknationradio.org, and I encourage everyone to phone and call. But then let's say the mayor does not veto. Is the military bound to obey the city? And what role, if any, is played by Congress? I know that Congressman Welch and Senators Leahy and Sanders have been supportive of putting the F-35 in Burlington, but I've noticed that since he stopped running for president, Bernie Sanders has suddenly been willing to be a little bit anti-war, much more anti-war in recent months than prior. I mean, is there a chance of bringing him around on this? And if so, what's the role of Congress?
Yeah, once these resolutions are adopted, and it's before the Air Force for a decision, they could still decide to force the F-35 on the unwilling population in Burlington, South Burlington, and Winooski. And they could go ahead and do that. I don't think they will want to do that because it's going to be decades of conflict for them. And there's going to be a continuing campaign against the F-35 basing, even after it arrives, if they do decide to force it on the population here. This is the most densely populated part of Vermont. So it's totally inappropriate. And in fact, the Air Force itself did not want to base it here. It was a pressure decision, the pressure being applied by Senator Leahy, Patrick Leahy, the most senior senator in the U.S. Senate, who, for whatever reason, and we don't know the reason, because he's refused to talk with anyone who opposes the F-35 basing. He's just refused any kind of contact. So we're hoping that these votes will influence at least one of the members of the congressional delegation. There are three members of our congressional delegation in Vermont, our two senators, Sanders and Leahy, and our sole congressman, Peter Welch. So far, they've acted in lockstep, following the lead of Senator Leahy. That could change, and we're hoping to apply persuasive arguments and public pressure of every possible way to influence them to be reasonable and to listen to the voters. We do think we have some democratic rights and that we have terrific arguments and facts that Burlington is not the place. And, in fact, no place is the right place to base F-35 jets. They're designed to attack third world countries for racist wars. They're not designed to protect anyone in Vermont. They may, we've had enough of these kinds of wars. Iraq was a total disaster. It produced far greater threats to the United States. It caused all this emigration and dislocation and death and injury, not just to American soldiers, but to a million Iraqis. This is not the kind of thing Vermont wants to be involved in. And we voted against these kinds of wars over and over again throughout Vermont. So we think we have, we can make a case that, and hopefully we will persuade Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, Leahy, and Congressman Welch.
Well, I am very hopeful that it matters and that the precedent of it mattering can be extended to other locations within and without the United States. I used to live in a city in Italy that held a public referendum and overthrew the government locally and nationally in Italy over just this sort of issue, and the U.S. Army went right ahead anyway. And, you know, you've got far more densely populated places in places like Okinawa with routine plane crashes crashes and other disasters, and the U.S. military just does not care what people in Japan or Korea or Italy or many other places think. So if
so
they,
that has to change. That has to change.
It has to change.
And it's necessary, and I think it, and we are already in contact with people at locations around the country and in other countries where this kind of horrendous basing of military jets is contemplated and is actually happening. And I think we will be involved in helping to build a worldwide campaign against the militarization of civilian areas. It's
right.
Illegal under international law to make people into human shields, and that's what this does. These are nuclear-capable bombers. They're capable of carrying, and they're slated to carry, the B-61 nuclear bomb. That makes Burlington a target, a legitimate military target. So that puts the entire population of 125,000 people who live within 5 miles of the airport at risk. And that's wrong. That's not consistent with U.S. obligations under international law.
Jimmy, we created, with a great deal of help from you, a petition at rootsaction.org demanding the complete abolition of the F-35 program, and got support from people and groups in numerous locations like Burlington, where the F-35 was to be based. Is this now a good time to get back in touch with other locations? Is this still a good strategy to try to stop the F-35 in one place and then another and then another?
Yes, that is a good strategy. The F-35 is totally a boondoggle. It's designed to transfer public money into private hands. It's not a weapon that is defending America or anybody else. It's designed for first strike attack. It's for aggression. And its very purpose is in violation of agreements like the UN Charter that the U.S. has solemnly adopted. So this is something that we want to build a campaign worldwide to stop. It's not just a moral issue. It's also a budgetary issue. The F-35 campaign, according to the Air Force and Lockheed Martin, is going to cost $1.4 trillion in lifetime cost. We don't need to waste $1.4 trillion when we could use that money for health care, housing, and education. This is something, and rebuilding our infrastructure and so many positive things that would make the U.S. population safer and more and happier and more productive. So we've got to stop the waste and abuse of spending $1.4 trillion on an aircraft that has that must not be used. When we start dropping nuclear bombs, that puts civilization at risk. And it's also put civilization at risk because it is going to foment and increase global warming, the other threat to civilization.
Indeed.
It's not just because it burns 1,100 gallons an hour at its most fuel conservative in straight and level flight when it's trying to get the greatest range. It's also because its purpose is wars for resources, especially for oil and for regime change, destabilizing countries like Libya and Iraq and Syria and Yemen. This is the kind of thing that that is contrary to the that puts at risk the existence of civilization in both ways, both global warming and nuclear annihilation.
But Jimmy, Lisa, good. We have just a few minutes left. Correct me if I'm wrong. A lot of these concerns, which are incredibly important and valid, are not the concerns that the city council has addressed to the military. And there's a potential here that the military comes back with a plane that's just as deadly, just as environmentally destructive and so forth, but less noisy. What happens at that point?
Right. So it's going... One of the features that we it's certainly true that the key feature that that is of concern to the population, especially people who live in the towns that are most affected by the noise, South Burlington and Winooski, is the very impact. The terrible negative impact on their families and their children. And so if the Air Force is thoughtful and smart enough to come back with another aircraft that is equally deadly and equally global warming and nuclear war, but quieter and safer, I think they will... likely be able to get support for doing that. But many of us will certainly object to it. I don't know that we'll be able to be as successful at objecting to it. We'll have to see. This whole militarization of Vermont and many other places in the U.S. is one of the features of the decline of the whole economic system we have, that we are relying more and more on militarization. And so it's detracting. It's like, as President Eisenhower said, it's either guns or butter. When you can't have both, that's what we are having now. We have a situation where more and more resources are being applied to the military, and the whole economy is being subverted by that approach.
Jimmy Lise, we've got just about a minute left. Why don't you give us again the mayor of Burlington's email address and phone number, as well as anything else people can do to get involved and support this effort and get it across the finish line?
It's Mayor Miro, M-I-R-O, Weinberger. His number is 802-865-7272, and his email address is mayor, M-A-Y-O-R, at Burlington, D-T, for Vermont, .gov. So that's mayor at Burlington, V-T, .gov. And I'd really like to thank you, David, for coming up to Vermont last year, and I hope we'll get to see you again very soon to help build the movement here in Vermont. And people all around the country, I think we've reached a point with President Trump where it's really possible build a mass campaign against so many of the issues. There's so many of the issues. This is one, but there are so many issues upon which we can work together to build a mass movement for peace and justice.
We will do so. Jimmy Lise, James Mark Lise, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we record, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is saying the death toll is now 19 Palestinians killed by Israeli military, with hundreds more injured, on March 30th during a protest near the fence along the border between Israel and the occupied region of Gaza. Israeli media offer a more complicated understanding of events than U.S. media, who seem to suggest that there's an Israeli position and a Palestinian position, but no actual reality worth trying to discern. We'll talk about the Gaza protests with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of, among other titles, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. Also on the show, the term Orwellian may be overused, but if the spectacle of dozens of local TV anchors being required to recite a script provided by their corporate owner that declares that fake news is dangerous to democracy doesn't meet the criterion, well, nothing does. A viral video brought home the creepiness, but it only begins to tell the story of Sinclair Broadcast Group. We'll hear more from Pam Vogel, research fellow at the group Media Matters. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. One could forgive the average reader for thinking reporters covering bots have been replaced by bots. Fair analyst Adam Johnson writes about the now familiar routine. A controversial story breaks. Media outlets insist that Russian bots used the controversy to sow discord or exploit tensions, and a Russian bot dashboard is offered as proof. These dashboards let one see what these automated online persona controlled by the Kremlin are allegedly pushing on social media. Russian bots, we are to understand, are now rushing to defend Fox News host Laura Ingraham in her weird fight with Parkland shooting survivor David Hogg. That's after they were blamed for pushing for Roy Moore to win in Alabama's special election, drawing attention to the Devin Nunes memo and all sort of other things. One problem? The Russian bot dashboard reporters generally cite as their primary source, Hamilton 68, effectively told reporters to stop writing these articles 6 weeks ago. According to a report from BuzzFeed, most bot stories are traced back to Hamilton 68, founded by a group of respected researchers, one of whom, Clint Watts, says, "I'm not convinced on this bot thing," citing the fact that not all the dashboard bots are connected to Russia, that it's hard to discern bot activity versus normal online trend chasing, and that the obsession with Russia lets the tons of bots run out of other places, including the U.S., off the hook. The effect of this reporting trend, Johnson notes, is not just that online conflict is neatly dismissed as a Kremlin psyop and that the narrative of Russian interference in every aspect of our lives is reinforced, but that the substance of the concern or the discord is underreported or ignored. For example, when a flurry of African-American Twitter users alleged a racist double standard in the coverage of the Austin, Texas bombings in March, which killed two people, both of them black, NPR didn't address the concerns by investigating their merit, but by running a story headed, "Russian social accounts adding to complaints that Austin bombings aren't being covered." The fact that the formula is still being applied weeks after the primary source's co-founder declared the story overdone suggests that corporate media see some value in a storyline that not only reminds us that the enemy lurks everywhere, but but that implies that unrest in this country is artificially contrived by a foreign entity. Russian bots, the New York Times complained, are, quote, creating public doubt in institutions like the police or media, close quote. If only that were it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The March 30th New York Times headline, Israeli military kills 15 Palestinians in confrontations on Gaza border, was refreshing in its avoidance of the passive voice often used to describe such things. But then the word confrontations returns us to that sense that media coverage of Israel and Palestine often gives of a symmetry of equally powerful forces. Indeed, a subsequent Times editorial, after the death toll had risen to 17, with more than 1,000 Palestinians wounded, would call on both Israel and the Palestinians to act with restraint, or the paper said both sides could face a new catastrophe. Joining us now to give us some context for recent events in Gaza is Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's author of many books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, now in its sixth updated edition. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Janine.
Could you tell us, first of all, the nature and the purpose of the demonstrations themselves, the demonstrations that were so violently countered by Israeli military?
Sure. I would just point out one additional point, though, about the Times coverage. The article that you were talking about, the title, which avoided this usual way of not talking about Israeli obligations and Israeli responsibility, was not reflected in the print edition.
Ah.
The print edition Saturday morning, although there was a huge four-column-wide photograph of Palestinian protesters, the title is Confrontations at Gaza Fence Leave 15 Dead.
Now,
it wasn't confrontations that killed those people. It's now up to 18, as we know. It was the Israeli military. And the caption on the photographs describes how demonstrations quickly turned violent. Well, the demonstrations never turned violent. There were a few stones thrown. There were two people who allegedly were seen with guns at one point. No one on the Israeli side was hurt. Whether those guns were ever fired, we don't know. There were somewhere around 30,000 people at this protest. So to call the fact that one or two people were seen with a gun that may never have been fired, the demonstrations turned violent, is really a deliberate misstatement of what happened. These protests, Janine, had two basic reasons. The long-term one had to do with the Palestinian right of return. 80% of the Gaza population are refugees. And this year is the 70th anniversary of what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, which is the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from their home in 1947 and 48 that led to the creation of the State of Israel. And, of course, they've never been allowed to return since. So this was partly about putting the right of return not as an immediate demand, we want it today, but as a recognition in the eyes of the world that this is still an unrealized right of the Palestinians under international law, according to UN Resolution 194. In all of these ways, Palestinians have the right to return. It is still being denied 70 years later, and we're still here to remind you. The immediate date had to do with an anniversary of what the Palestinians call Land Day, which was a protest back in 1976 when Israel was, at that time, as it is now, continuing to expropriate Palestinian land. In this case, it was a large part of land in the Galilee, inside Israel. And there were lots of protests by Palestinian citizens of Israel. Six of them were shot dead by Border Patrol agents, which was unprecedented at that time for Palestinian citizens to be shot in cold blood like this. And as a result, every year on March 30th, Land Day is commemorated for that continuing nonviolent fight for the land. So the date of the beginning of what is anticipated to be a six-week nonviolent protest began this year on Land Day. So it was the combination of those two things that led to the protests.
What you've just described sounds very different than the characterization that was pretty pervasive in media. NPR had it, quote, tens of thousands of people in Gaza answered the militant group Hamas's call to protest, close quote.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. That was picked up all over the place, that Hamas somehow was the originator of this thing. It wasn't. This was Palestinian civil society in Gaza, which is very vibrant despite the horrific conditions where there's 97% of the small amount of water available is undrinkable. Electricity is only available between 2 and 4 hours a day. The sewage system has never been rebuilt after the 2014 assault by the Israeli military, with the result that the beaches have been fouled. It's a horrific catastrophe of humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And yet, there are these very vibrant social movements and organizations, women's organizations, trade unions, youth organizations, sports clubs. All of these were involved in calling for this protest. The protest organizers asked for endorsement and support from all the political parties and got it. They all signed on, Fatah, Hamas, all of them. And because Hamas controls the, to whatever degree it exists, which isn't much, but the degree to which a governing structures exist in Gaza, it's controlled by Hamas. They're the ruling party. They won the elections in 2006. And in that context, they provided bus availability to get people to the area where the protests were happening, that sort of thing. But the idea that this was somehow called by Hamas is simply not true. Hamas rarely calls for this kind of mass protest, largely because they don't control it. And there's a lot of discontent in Gaza with Hamas, as with Fatah, in the context of the much greater anger at Israel for the years of occupation and siege and this long-standing blockade that's been underway that prevents Palestinians from having a functioning economy, from having clean water, from being able to travel, from being able to escape from what many around the world have called an open-air prison.
Well, you know, conversations around Israel-Palestine can be so kind of Manichaean. I mean, people simply say, oh, no, you're wrong. You know, actually, these protesters are all violent and they don't believe that Israel should exist. And what I'm thinking of in particular is Israel's ambassador to the UN, you've just described, and we sometimes hear about humanitarian conditions within Gaza. Israel's ambassador to the UN has a letter in the Times saying, we are not responsible for the well-being of the people of Gaza. I mean, stating that as a simple fact. So how does one make sense of something like that?
Well, I think the problem is that the Times lets him get away with that. You know, if I wrote a letter like that, I think it would probably be fact-checked to say, hasn't Israel in fact imposed a blockade in which all the entrances and exits are controlled by Israel? There is no alternative way for the Palestinians to, for example, bring in either humanitarian or commercial goods to rebuild the water treatment or sewage treatment plants. Isn't it true, Mr. Ambassador, that all of those entrances remain to this day under Israeli control, except for the one at Rafah, which is controlled by Egypt, which has agreed with Israel to keep it shut also? This isn't rocket science. This isn't brain surgery. This isn't hard. The reason the Israeli ambassador can make a statement like that is simply because no one challenges him. I think what is important right now, and what's not getting enough attention, is the fact that Israeli human rights organizations, one in particular, B'Tselem, the very respected, long-standing human rights group inside Israel, started a campaign yesterday that is absolutely unprecedented. In a set of ads around the country, they are calling on Israeli soldiers to deliberately resist orders to shoot to kill. They've used the term patently illegal to describe these orders to shoot anyone approaching the fence. And the reason that that phrase is so important, it has a particular history in Israeli military law. In 1956, there was another massacre of Palestinians in a village called Kfar Qasim, a very well-known massacre site. And on that occasion, the village had been put under a sudden curfew by the military with virtually no announcement. And the Border Patrol agents were told by their commanders, shoot to kill anyone who comes outside his home or her home. And the Border Police went along with that. And they fired and they killed 47 Palestinians. These were Israeli Palestinians. This was inside Israel in 1956. And at that time, there was a legal challenge. And the judges found that the order to shoot was what they called patently illegal. And they went on to define what that meant in saying that what the soldiers were essentially trying to use was the Nuremberg defense. I was just following orders. And the judges said that's not okay, and that an order that is patently illegal must be disobeyed. And they described what that means as saying, and this is, I'm quoting the judges here, Israeli judges, we're not dealing with a formal, hidden or not, illegality, not one seen only by scholars of law, but a clear and obvious illegality, a certain and essential illegality of the order itself, an illegality which pierces the eye and enrages the heart, assuming the eye is not blind and the heart is not made of stone or corrupt. It was an extraordinary, almost poetic description of how outrageous and how obviously illegal this order was, kill anybody outside their home, in their own village, you know. The same way, the idea that you can shoot anybody who approaches the border fence on their own side of the border when no one is at risk, there is no danger to life, there is no mortal threat, which is the only basis on which live fire can be used. It's patently illegal. And using that term is a very important one. Now, the sad reality is that neither B'Tselem nor the other brave Israeli human rights organizations have very much influence these days, as the political discourse inside Israel has moved so far to the right, unfortunately, particularly among young people. Mm. But it is important for the international community that Israeli human rights defenders themselves are actually calling on their own soldiers to defy these illegal orders. That puts the human rights activists themselves at B'Tselem at great risk, and their willingness to take that risk of isolation at the very least, if not potential legal consequences, it speaks to how serious this set of violations is and speaks to the obligation of the international community to answer it.
We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of, among other titles, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, now in its sixth updated edition. Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It's always a pleasure.
The viral video of dozens of local newscasters from around the country reciting identical scripts about fake news is the definition of painful irony. But what Sinclair Broadcast Group, the parent company that forced the broadcasters to parrot the words, is doing and wants to do is no laughing matter. Sinclair's been largely under the radar till now, though known to some as the owner that forced its stations to run a pseudo-documentary hit piece on John Kerry days before the 2004 election. The chain's Washington bureau chief resisted, told the Baltimore Sun, quote, I couldn't be part of this special and call it news when what it is political propaganda, close quote, and was promptly fired. So what does it mean that Sinclair may acquire a station in your town next? Our next guest has been immersed in things Sinclair. Pam Vogel is a research fellow at Media Matters. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Pam Vogel.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with that video that Deadspin cut together. It's chilling in its content. People who obviously don't have any control over what they're saying, talking about free speech and mind control. You know, someone said it looks like hostage video, and in a way it almost is. People need their jobs after all. The must run is a significant part of the Sinclair way, isn't it?
Yes, and this sort of scripted segment that's read by local anchors isn't necessarily typical for Sinclair. It's a little bit of an escalation, which I think is maybe why some folks are so riled up when they see this video. It does feel very eerie and disingenuous. But in addition to a sort of scripted segment like the one in that video, Sinclair regularly mandates that all of its local TV news stations run certain types of segments that they produce nationally at their headquarters near us here in D.C. So those types of must-run segments are more regularly produced. There's one called Bottom Line with Boris, and that is featuring a man named Boris Epstein, who used to be a Trump aide, and he was hired by Sinclair a little bit after he left the White House. And his commentary segments are produced pretty much every weekday. There is a new one. They're pretty short, about 90 seconds, 2 minutes, and it's pretty predictable. So I watch all of them as they come out, and I already know what's going to be in them for the most part. It's always either an agreement with President Trump or a defense of something that Trump has done, or in a few cases, including yesterday, a defense of Sinclair itself or a defense of Epstein's commentary segments. And the second must-run that they typically are mandating that their stations air is called Terrorism Alert Desk. Those also are relatively short segments. They're produced about every other day there's a new one. And those are sort of quick hit, vague headline reading of stories that they have determined are about terrorism. And I watch a year of those segments. And some of the things that we sort of pulled away in analysis of those segments were that they weren't very informative for viewers, but the repetition aspect of reading vague headlines about things like terror-related arrests, where we never get any follow-up information, a focus overall on terror associated with Islam, taken all together like that, it really just serves as a way to gin up xenophobia in local news audiences. So I think when we talk about that context of some of the other must-run segments Sinclair's doing, the idea of having local anchors decry one-sided and biased news feels even more ironic.
Really takes it over the top. And it's two things, because it's the content and then it's the nature of it being must run. There was a guy who worked briefly at a Sinclair station named Aaron Weiss, who wrote a piece for Huffington Post, and he recounted a conference call of news directors when someone asked if they could ever run local commentary during newscasts, and the answer was a firm no. You know, so the threat of Sinclair, the concern is not just that it's right wing, it's what they mean for the localism of local news as well, isn't it?
Yes. There was a recent study out of Emory University where the authors found that a small group of stations last year was acquired by Sinclair. And when those stations saw the transfer in ownership, that was pretty much immediately accompanied by a change in the types of news that those stations covered. So they began to cover more national stories at the expense of local stories.
Yeah, I saw that Emory research, and I thought it was interesting that they found just the more national politics as opposed to local and a slant to the right. And then they note that the results suggest a substantial supply side role in these trends toward nationalization and polarization of politics news. In other words, the changes weren't responsive to viewers' tastes changing. They really just came from the ownership changing.
And this is something to keep in mind when we're talking about Sinclair, too, because they're in the middle of trying to finalize an acquisition of more media stations across the country, 42 more local TV stations, some in the largest media markets, New York, Chicago, LA, where they don't really currently have any stations that they control, whether it's through ownership or whether through operating them solely, which is part of Sinclair's MO. But it speaks to their efforts to consolidate, and they view it as a win for innovation. But what really happens is that they're free to minimize the resources that stations need, which, again, takes away from the localism. And it can be also kind of creepy in a way that's a little bit similar to the way that these local anchors were mandated to read those scripts. We're seeing other instances already with Sinclair stations where they're using the same local anchors broadcasting from one station in one state, and they're actually narrating nightly news segments in other states.
So it's not even really local at all at this point. And this is in a time in which local news resources are already shrinking or have already been dwindling.
Exactly. So to be clear, in that sort of arrangement, they still have some local reporters that are in the community.
Right.
But the anchors at the desk are in a completely different state. So they're basically making the argument through the way that they are allocating those resources, that the anchors don't matter. It just seems like overall a kind of lack of respect for journalistic integrity for their employees.
Absolutely. Well, I did read that David Smith, the chairman of Sinclair, has quipped that Sinclair is forever expanding like the universe. That doesn't sound good. You just hinted toward it. They are trying now to have a huge acquisition or an acquisition that would get them into the three biggest markets in the country. So what's in between them and that right now?
Yes. The acquisition is waiting final approval from the FTC and from the Department of Justice on antitrust grounds. And it's pretty much expected that both of those entities will approve the deal. They're obviously pretty aligned with the Trump administration, and President Trump has vocalized his support for Sinclair in two tweets in the last couple of days. So I don't think we're going to see any pushback there. But one thing that is interesting is that the FTC is actually under an internal investigation right now because they've made so many moves, regulatory and deregulatory, in the last year since they acquired a Republican majority on that commission because of the Trump administration, to make things easier for Sinclair to see that deal through. They reinstated some outdated, wonky math for calculating ownership caps that basically is allowing Sinclair to own an unprecedented number of stations and reach up to 72% of U.S. television households, which is completely unheard of and wouldn't have been possible before the FCC was under Republican control.
I want to be clear, it's not like there's a Sinclair network and that if you don't want it, you can avoid it. You know, that's part of the problem, is that it's kind of a labeling issue as well, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. If you're tuning into cable news, Fox, MSNBC, CNN, you sort of know what you're tuning into. You're signing up for something specific, whether it's news delivered with a particular perspective, whether it's commentators that have a national profile, and so you might know already what their background is and their approach. But with Sinclair, you don't have that same expectation. So if you're turning to your local nightly news, you might see that it's called ABC 6 or CBS 12, but you don't see a Sinclair logo anywhere on your screen. The good news is it's relatively easy to find out who owns your station, and that's exactly what Sinclair doesn't want folks to do. They kind of have thrived for so long under the radar. So I think now that people are becoming aware of what they've been up to, it's important to keep that drumbeat going and to take a little bit of time to just know who owns your station, because they're not making it very clear.
We've been speaking with Pam Vogel. She's research fellow at Media Matters. They're online at mediamatters.org. Pam Vogel, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
As the nuclear accidents at Fukushima, Japan, and Chernobyl taught us, a nuclear accident anywhere affects my listeners around the world. Donald Trump sat down for dinner with a nuclear lobbyist the other night. He wants more taxpayer money and higher electricity rates, now that the coal and nuclear industries have gone bankrupt. We cover the scam with longtime nuclear campaigner Kevin Camps. Then strange new science says plants in a high carbon atmosphere will determine who gets the crops and who gets the drought. We'll hear from Dr. Pierre Gentine from the Columbia University School of Engineering and Applied Science. The future is already here on Radio EcoShock. Donald Trump's administration has landed another no-win situation. Should his clueless Energy Secretary Rick Perry order subsidies to keep old nuclear reactors and polluting coal plants going, even as they go bankrupt? That would please big donors to the Trump campaign, but it might not make the millions of people in Trump-voting states in the Midwest happy when they get higher electricity bills for years to come. We're back in that un-merry-go-round as the big power company First Energy declared bankruptcy. Three risky reactors could close, but is it a ploy for more public money into a privately held corporation? It's time to ask one of my favorite nuclear correspondents, Kevin Camps, from the nonprofit Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
So you say there's news on that right in today's paper.
Yeah, Steve Mufson in the Washington Post broke the story today that Donald Trump will be sitting down for dinner with a top lobbyist from First Energy Nuclear, who happened to be the campaign manager for Rick Perry's presidential bid in the past. So I wonder what they'll be talking about.
Well, isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah, you know, it is kind of scary. It's a really outrageous proposal that First Energy put forth just days ago under the Federal Power Act. It's called a 202C emergency petition, and it's usually reserved for national emergencies like wartime or a natural disaster. The only emergency here is that First Energy has been making very bad business decisions for not years but decades, and they would like the Department of Energy to bail them out massively. And what's scary is that Rick Perry has attempted to. Even just this year, he applied to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to bail out the entire coal and nuclear industry nationwide, but it would be especially beneficial to First Energy. And that argument was, boy, coal and nuke plants have storage of fuel on site. So, you know, if something happens like a polar vortex, they're going to have fuel on site. And that thing fell flat on its face. There was large resistance from competitors, other industries, other fuel sources, but also environmental groups, consumer groups. And there was contradictory information. For example, coal sometimes freezes in severe winter weather and can't be used to generate electricity. So that failed, but it just shows the lengths to which Rick Perry is willing to go to try to bail out the coal and nuclear industries.
Yeah, there's an emergency, all right. It's in my pocketbook. Would you give me a whole bunch of money, billions of dollars, please? You know, I'd like to start talking a little bit about some of the nuclear plants that could close if all goes well. And let's start with the Davis-Besse nuclear plant near Toledo, Ohio. Why would it be a relief, Kevin, for everyone if that old plant closes down a little early?
We've been very active on Davis-Besse for a long time because it is one of the most risky reactors, not only in the U.S., but probably in the world. It's had more close calls with catastrophe than any single reactor that I know of. It's a three-mile island twin design. In fact, it had a precursor incident about 18 months before the three-mile island Unit 2 meltdown. Fortunately, it got resolved at Davis-Besse, but was kept secret. I wonder why. and the information was not communicated to the twin design at Three Mile Island Unit 2, and that one had a 50% meltdown. And then you just keep going. It's had a half dozen or more near misses. One of the most infamous was in 2002. It was called the hole in the head fiasco, where the reactor lid had a massive corrosion hole in it. It was covered up by the company at the highest levels and came within literally 3/16ths of an inch of breaching, because that was all that was left, was stainless steel liner, and it was bulging through the hole and was soon to burst. And that's how close they came to having a meltdown. And then we learned in 2011 that Davis-Besse's containment, its concrete shield building, is severely cracked, has been since 1978, and the cracking is worsening over time. So if they had had a meltdown at any of these close calls, the containment would not have held it in, and it would have been a catastrophic release of hazardous radioactivity into the environment. So for safety's sake, Davis-Besse must be shut down.
Yeah, we won't even mention the fact that it was hit by a tornado that sent them off running on backup generators. Look, wasn't First Energy fined millions of dollars for lying about reactor safety at Davis-Besse?
Yeah, I believe that would be the hole-in-the-head fiasco. It was a record-breaking fine by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, $33 million, if memory serves. And the Department of Justice had scathing words to say about First Energy's behavior. And then First Energy tried to essentially perpetrate insurance fraud. They gave one version of events about the hole in the head to the NRC. They gave the opposite version of events to their own insurance company, trying to make it look like they had nothing to do with this. It just happened. How could they have known? And the insurance company, of course, was a little skeptical, and they didn't get away with it. But this is a crooked company, and that's another whole kettle of fish regarding, you know, the safety risks involved.
Well, Kevin, give me a minute to rant about another nuclear myth that bothers me. There is another First Energy nuclear plant, the Beaver Valley Power Station near Shippingport, Pennsylvania, and it's pretty darn close to Pittsburgh. And that whole area has been nuclearized for a long time. Shippingport, as you know, was the site of the first supposed civilian nuclear power station. And I say supposed because that first reactor was really designed for an aircraft carrier that was never built. And because the Atoms for Peace program, pushed by General Eisenhower, always hoped to support a continuing nuclear industry, I think, to make atomic weapons. And now they tell us that Shippingport, that reactor's all cleaned up. The public can tour around the site, but it's cleaned up because they put the whole reactor on a barge and they brought it to Washington State near me. They just buried the reactor in the badly run Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Nothing was cleaned up at all, really. And that's the truth about nuclear power. There's no way to decontaminate a reactor permanently. We just try to hide that radioactivity somewhere else and hope it doesn't escape. That's practically your whole job at Beyond Nuclear. Is it true that it's a myth that we can clean this stuff up when these plants do shut down?
Yeah, they really are lying in a bad way. That's a whole other aspect of this First Energy bankruptcy. It's announced closures of a total of four atomic reactors because there's two units at Beaver Valley still operating. Is Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago, to give credit where credit is due, they just filed an emergency enforcement petition of their own at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, pointing out that First Energy Nuclear's decommissioning trust funds are woefully inadequate for the job ahead. So if they do shut Davis-Besse in 2020, as they've announced, and then Perry in Ohio and Beaver Valley Units 1 and 2 in 2021 in Pennsylvania there, then the decommissioning is ahead. And what Environmental Law and Policy Center has pointed out to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is, there is not enough money to do an adequate cleanup job. So they have to dismantle the facilities. They have to clean up the radioactive contamination in the soil, in the groundwater, in the flora, in the fauna. And like you said about the reactor pressure vessel from Shippingport, which was essentially Beaver Valley Unit 1, it wasn't called that, going out to Hanford Nuclear Reservation to Richland, Washington, to be buried in an unlined ditch. There are so many problems here. What they do during cleanup is they transfer the contamination somewhere else to a dump site. So right now, as we speak, with the growing number of decommissioning projects going on, the biggest ever in U.S. history at Zion, Units 1 and 2, north of Chicago, they send the radioactive contaminations to places like Clive, Utah. That's called Energy Solutions. It can take the lowest category, of so-called low-level radioactive waste. Then you've got Waste Control Specialists Limited Liability Corporation in West Texas on the New Mexico state line. They take Class A, Class B, and Class C. So now you're getting more and more intensively radioactive, and they're dumping it above the Oglala Aquifer. And, you know, every single so-called low-level radioactive waste dump in U.S. history, there have been more than a half dozen, have leaked. So Barnwell, South Carolina is infamous for that. Beatty, Nevada actually experienced geysers of radioactive waste, if you can believe it, explosions of radioactive waste, because they had mixed the radioactive waste there with explosive, on contact with water, sodium metal. And so this was a couple years ago. They had a flash flood in Beatty, Nevada, and they had geysers shooting radioactive waste some 50-plus feet into the air. So that's how low-level radioactive waste disposal is going in the United States.
Wow. When it comes to FirstEnergy, too, you know, Kevin, the company that just declared bankruptcy, it goes beyond nuclear to coal. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the biggest coal supplier to FirstEnergy plants is Murray Energy. The CEO of the company, Robert E. Murray, and that's the guy who tried to sue John Oliver. Murray donated millions to the Trump campaign. Then he called on the Department of Energy to supplement the price of coal. That was turned down so far. What the heck happened to the free market?
Yeah, Murray is a huge coal supplier to FirstEnergy. FirstEnergy is $2.8 billion in debt, and that includes not being able to fulfill coal transportation contracts with its vendors. So, you know, I don't have any evidence that Murray's invited to this private dinner tonight, but FirstEnergy's top lobbyist is, who ran Rick Perry's presidential campaign. And so, you know, Murray tried earlier to get Rick Perry and Donald Trump to declare a national emergency surrounding his business, his, you know, his decision to go coal decades ago. Well, guess what? Coal is in deep trouble right now. And so the national emergency for people like Murray and for FirstEnergy is that they made very bad investments in the past, and it has caught up to them. And they would like, you know, the Trump administration to bail them out to the tune of not really billions, but really hundreds of billions, because that earlier Rick Perry application to FERC, that figure was something like $180 billion over time for coal and nuclear subsidies. And didn't get away with that one. And here comes FirstEnergy again, trying yet again.
And FirstEnergy tries to say that their nuclear and coal generating stations are some kind of baseload necessity and the system could not run safely without them. Kevin Camps, would any of those Midwest states go dark without that nuclear power?
There is something like a 30% higher than that, over 30% glut of electricity on the PJM grid, especially close in to Ohio and northwest Pennsylvania. 30% excess of electricity. They have plenty of backup electricity to spare, too much, actually. And PJM, Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland grid, the largest in the country, it actually extends to Illinois, they have fired back immediately on this talk by FirstEnergy of an emergency blackouts if these plants shut down 3 years from now. PJM is fighting back. But, you know, as I say that, there are moves afoot even within PJM itself to try to subsidize at least nuclear, if not also coal, if not other sources of fossil fuel electricity. So we have to be vigilant against PJM, but this current FirstEnergy proposal is outlandish in PJM's eyes. So it's just, it's desperation by FirstEnergy. But they've been trying for over 5 years to get subsidies at the state level in Ohio, at the federal level time and time again, and we just keep fighting them off as best we can.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. We're talking about the bankrupt nuclear industry and whether the taxpayers and the ratepayers should just fund it all now that the investors are losing money. According to Wikipedia, the FirstEnergy nuclear plants, like the Perry plant near Cleveland, are expected, as you say, to close around 2020, 21, maybe. That's just 3 or 4 years from now anyway. They're old. They're costly to keep up. Do you think they will close then, Kevin, or are their licenses going to be extended forever?
Well, we tried to block the Davis-Bessey license extension, which was a 2017 to 2037 license extension. The NRC rubber stamped it anyway in late 2015. This, despite everything I mentioned earlier about the many close calls with catastrophe at Davis-Bessie over the decades, even recently, and the fact that the containment is severely cracked and worsening with time, which means there is no containment. In fact, the containment is so bad in terms of cracking at Davis-Bessie that it is a risk of causing a meltdown, because if they have spalling of exterior face concrete on the outside of the shield building, it would fall down onto, perhaps it could fall down onto, safety significant systems, structures, and components down below. It could initiate the meltdown. And I say all that just to say that these reactors, for safety reasons, should be shut down as soon as possible. 3 or 4 more years of operations really represents a form of radioactive Russian roulette on the Lake Erie shoreline in northern Ohio and on the Beaver River, which feeds the Ohio in northwest Pennsylvania. And Perry has, you know, skeletons in its closet. It's infamous for worker overexposures to radioactivity. It has a very lax safety culture. Beaver Valley is infamous, as revealed by Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds in Vermont, for having a breached containment as well. And that goes back to construction of the containment. They left equipment in the containment that actually formed a breach through the wall. And that was the soft spot where the radioactivity and the pressure would have found a way out in the event of a core meltdown, which could still happen.
Tell us more, Kevin, about what has happened in other states regarding subsidizing old nuclear plants.
Well, unfortunately, at least thus far, we've lost that battle in places like New York State, a $7.6 billion subsidy by ratepayers. This is Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, who made this happen, and his Public Service Commission. $7.6 billion bailout to keep 4 old reactors operating another 12 years. And it's under court review. Some really great groups like Nuclear Information and Resource Service are suing the Cuomo administration and the Public Service Commission over this ratepayer robbery, essentially. And the money was stolen from a clean energy fund, if you can believe that. Some of those reactors had actually announced shutdown as early as January of 2017, I think it was. And that bailout reversed that shutdown announcement. And the company that is entirely benefiting from this massive subsidy is Exelon Nuclear of Chicago. And speaking of Illinois, we also have lost that battle thus far in Illinois. $2.35 billion to keep 3 old reactors operating another 10 years. And again, Exelon had announced shutdown dates for those reactors. And what the pattern shows is the nuclear utilities, Exelon, First Energy, use these threatened shutdowns as a sort of nuclear hostage taking. They say, oh, all these jobs are going to be lost. All these municipal tax revenues are going to dry up. Well, you know, reactors have to shut down someday. They need to be planning for that transition. It needs to be a just transition for the workforce and the host communities. But they're just playing games with people's lives, livelihoods, community support in the form of tax revenues and charitable donations that they give, which is pocket change for them, actually. And in addition, the safety risks. And these games have got to stop.
Meanwhile, we have a couple of billionaire kids hiring a former environmentalist to look like there's public support to keep the old nuclear plants going until they finally blow up. But there isn't that public support. Talk to us about Rachel Pritzker.
Yeah, I wish I understood her thinking. The Pritzkers are the heirs of the Hyatt Hotel fortune. And I don't think that all the Pritzker siblings are pro-nuclear, but Rachel apparently is very pro-nuclear, to the point where my first encounter with this was the propaganda film called Pandora's Promise, which we did a lot of work to try to rebut, which featured Michael Schellenberger of the Breakthrough Institute, who claimed to have parents who are anti-nuclear. He used to be anti-nuclear until he thought about it, and he came out pro-nuclear. And the film was ironic because they were really featuring a reactor technology called the Integral Fast Reactor, which failed in the 1950s. That was what was so ironic, was this is not a new reactor design. This is an ancient reactor design that already has shown that it's a failure. That's what they were pushing in this film. And now, unfortunately, Michael Schellenberger, still supported by Rachel Pritzker's money, And he gave her a huge thanks in the film, and so did Stone, the filmmaker, for all the support. He now has new adventures underway, a group called Environmental Progress, very Orwellian name, another group called Mothers for Nuclear, just a horrendous name. They happen to be moms who work as reactor control room operators, so they have no bias there. And they are showing up in places like Ohio, Illinois, California, trying to keep these old reactors operating. So one of the, you know, more ironic moments was when Schellenberger organized a Mothers for Nuclear protest at Greenpeace offices in San Francisco, protesting the decision to shut down the Diablo Canyon reactors in 2024 and 2025. What was ironic was the company made that decision, Pacific Gas and Electric, yes, in discussions with environmental groups, but not Greenpeace. Greenpeace was not at the table. It was Natural Resources Defense Council. It was Friends of the Earth. It was Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. It was the nuclear workforce unions. So why did they go to Greenpeace? I mean, it's this weird PR campaign that Schellenberger's up to. It's very cynical, and we fight him at every opportunity.
Yeah, years ago, I did a two-part series on Michael Schellenberger and the Breakthrough Institute, which really never made any breakthroughs. And they set up this so-called institute at a California shopping mall. He and Ted called themselves senior fellows, even though they had no academic training to speak of. They took money from big foundations. Then I see that in January 2016, Schellenberger split off with his own, more or less taking one of the prime donors with the Breakthrough Institute to fund his new group, Environmental Progress. As you say, it was Rachel Pritzker. And their idea of green is to keep old reactors going. And Schellenberger cites as, quote, Environmental Progress's biggest victories were saving America's largest source of clean energy, nuclear power, in Illinois and New York. We did so by building a humanistic environmental movement demanding energy justice for all. I mean, that's some kind of nuclear astroturfing. It's unbelievable.
It's environmental injustice, of course, because the ratepayers are getting gouged. And, you know, there are human beings, they use the word human there, who happen to be low income. They happen to be people of color many times. They can't afford these rate hikes that the nuclear subsidies represent. I was in First Energy country. I was in Akron, Ohio, where First Energy is headquartered. This was January of 2014. It was First Energy's attempt to get a massive $4-plus billion bailout out of the state of Ohio Public Utilities Commission public comment meeting in Akron. And I was heartbroken to be listening to young women, some were single moms, saying that if my electricity bill goes up any higher, I'm going to be homeless. And the hearing happened to be taking place during blizzard conditions. And it was just like, you got to be kidding me. And it's why groups like ARP are our allies on this, because seniors can't afford these rate hikes. And that is who's going to face the music, is people paying electricity bills, households, no matter how low income, small businesses, and even large businesses, major manufacturing corporations are opposing these bailouts because they have to pay those electricity bills. And that's the power of the nuclear lobby, is sometimes they get away with this despite that widespread opposition by essentially everybody else.
And with the Pritzker money and other nuclear donors, Michael Schellenberger sees lots of doors opening. Even though Schellenberger has zero training in nuclear physics and no experience in a nuclear plant, he's on MIT's Future of Nuclear Advisory Board. Michael claims he will give the keynote address at the annual conference of the American Nuclear Society meeting in San Francisco. Environmental Progress opened a 5,000-square-foot office and action center at street level, just three blocks from UC Berkeley. So, Kevin, I suppose they hope they can indoctrinate students and maybe gather up some misguided street power. It's fantastic mirroring of the environmental movement, only with really big bucks instead of scraping by. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's spinning the splitting of the atom. It's a PR exercise. Astroturfing is the perfect phrase to use for it. You know, another MIT pro-nuclear advocate is Ernest Moniz, who was Obama's energy secretary, who went through the revolving door to join the board of Southern Nuclear recently after, in 2014, giving Southern Nuclear an $8.3 billion federal taxpayer-backed nuclear loan guarantee, which then Trump administration just topped off with another $3.7 billion. So now you got a nice even $12 billion of federal taxpayer money at risk at Vogtle Units 3 and 4 in Georgia. And Moniz is sitting at the table now making the decisions on that going forward when it should have been canceled a long time ago. So Moniz, most recently in the First Energy context, incredibly, it was a national context, but First Energy is where the action is right now. He said, we have to keep our nuclear power industry going because the training and the know-how and the trained personnel are essential for our nuclear weapons arsenal. And what's astounding about that argument is that they've denied that for 7 decades. There is no connection between Atoms for Peace and Atoms for War. They're completely separate from each other. Well, Dr. Arjun Makhazani of Institute for Energy and Environmental Research wrote a book in 1999 called The Nuclear Power Deception. And he used primary documents going all the way back showing that, no, in fact, this Atoms for Peace speech that Eisenhower gave in 1953 at the United Nations was a smiley-faced facade for the nuclear weapons buildup. Where was all the uranium going? Yes, there was shipping port, which happened to be built, like it was built, like you said, by Admiral Hyman Rickover and his nuclear Navy men. So much for a civilian reactor, right? But it was an electricity generator for the Pittsburgh area. But where was all that uranium going in those first years and even decades, the 50s, the 60s, before there were many reactors at all? It was going into the nuclear weapons arsenal. So it was a justification for uranium mining and milling and processing and enrichment. It was feeding the nuclear arms race. So here we go. Now they're reversing their argument and saying we need Atoms for Peace so that we can be prepared to continue Atoms for War. And that's Moniz out of MIT. He's a nuclear engineering prof up there.
You know, I always knew it. We all always knew it. And now the documentation is coming out and now people are admitting it. You talked about mothers for nuclear power, and I looked into 3 or 4 of them and one wasn't a mother and all of them seem to work in the nuclear industry. So they just want to keep their jobs. But wouldn't real mothers be more concerned about leukemia clusters around the nuclear plants?
That's what's so cynical about what Schallenberger and his compatriots are up to. A lot of anti-nuclear groups actually grow out of leukemia, childhood leukemia support groups. I shouldn't say a lot, but some, and some powerful ones, like Cumbrians Opposed to a Radioactive Environment Core near the Sellafield nuclear complex in the United Kingdom. It actually grew out of a childhood leukemia support group. That's how it got started. Another similar story in Illinois, a mother whose daughter contracted a rare form of childhood brain cancer near the Braidwood and Dresden nuclear power plants in Illinois, only to find out that there were 5 rare childhood brain cancers at one elementary school where this young girl, 7 years old, went. The good news is she has survived. She's in remission. She's in her 20s now. Some of the other children did not. So that's what's going on. There have been studies in Germany where the closer you live to a nuclear power plant, the higher your risk of childhood leukemia. The International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War looked into it, and their concern is the refueling outages, that is when the worst radioactive discharges are taking place, you know, without accidents. This is routine radiation discharges as they refuel the atomic reactor. You know, no talk of evacuating the local population during refueling. We, of course, would like to abolish nuclear power, but just to keep everything seemingly clean in a PR sense, we don't even talk about it to the public. In fact, we deny there's any risk when there have been voices calling for at least temporary evacuations from the neighborhood while they refuel to spare children who are very much at risk because of their developing immune system, the division of their cells as they grow. They're at a heightened risk from the harm and hazard of radioactivity. No talk about, you know, getting people out of the way during these very dangerous time periods. So that's why what Schallenberger and Mothers for Nuclear are up to is so outrageous.
And he's all about the catchphrase. I mean, they call themselves atomic humanists and eco-modernists, and they claim to know how to save nature with disruptive technological change. I think these people hold a world record for dangerous green BS. That's my opinion.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear.
Yeah, I mean, one aspect of nuclear power that is very dangerous is the weapons proliferation that goes hand in hand with it. So as we speak, we have Saudi Arabia and lobbyists in the U.S. that is hired on Capitol Hill trying to get Congress to approve a nuclear power commerce deal with Saudi Arabia so that they can build 16 new reactors. And we've been warning, and many others, that if Saudi Arabia gets nuclear power, if they get uranium enrichment, if they get plutonium reprocessing, they could build a nuclear weapons arsenal with that. I mean, Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who's himself Egyptian, warned about that some years ago before he left and retired, Nobel Peace Prize in hand for his work on Iraq and Iran. But now we have the crown prince of Saudi Arabia in the last couple of weeks warning explicitly out loud that if Iran builds a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia will do so as well. So it's not just others warning about it. It's an openly admitted threat against Iran.
Well, that's what Mike Flynn, the disgraced Mike Flynn, got caught for heading to the Middle East while he was on the Trump campaign or in the administration trying to sell nuclear reactors in the Mideast and then not declaring that.
Yes, exactly. It's a little known aspect of the whole Russiagate and, Trump corruption, so to speak. So, you know, the crazy thing is not only is there the nuclear weapons proliferation potential, there's the risk of nuclear power plants being targeted in warfare or by terrorism. So there was a book written in 1984 by Bennett Ramberg entitled Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy. They essentially represent massive dirty bombs just sitting there waiting to be detonated to cause unimaginable harm to the local region out to a great distance. So it'd be an intentional, Fukushima or an intentional Chernobyl in that respect. So if you're going to build reactors in the Middle East, you're really asking for trouble. And just a case in point, about 2 months ago, I think, several weeks back, the Houthi rebels in Yemen fired a missile at a nuclear power plant in the United Arab Emirates that's under construction. It's not yet activated, so it's not yet radioactive. There was no fuel in the core, but it was the Houthi rebels warning United Arab Emirates and by implication Saudi Arabia, their biggest adversary of all, that they're in open warfare with, that we can target your nuclear power plants. So those are the kind of risks of building nuclear power plants in the Middle East. I mean, Israel took out Iraq's Ozerok reactor in 1981, I think it was. More recently, 2007, they took out a secretive Syrian nuclear power plant that was being built in cooperation with North Korea. So those are two examples, yet again, of pre-operational nuclear power plants being bombed by the Israeli military. The U.S. military, incredibly, in 1991, bombed an Iraqi research reactor that was operational, which means there was some radioactive releases to the environment. I don't know how bad it was. The fuel had been taken out of the core, but when you bomb a reactor that's been operational, it is radioactive and there will be releases.
And didn't Bin Laden have a sort of secondary plan of just taking those airplanes into the Indian Point reactor outside New York, which would cause millions of people to be irradiated?
Well, Mohammed Atta, the lead attacker in the first plane that hit the World Trade Center, wanted to attack Indian Point, lobbied for it within Al-Qaeda, was told no. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, under torture, admitted that the original plan was for 10 hijacked jetliners, two of which were to target nuclear facilities. And when an Al Jazeera reporter prior to his capture asked him why nuclear plants were not targeted, he said Al-Qaeda did not want things to get out of hand. So we rely on the moral restraint of terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda because of the incredible vulnerability of our nuclear power plants. And it's not the reactor per se, although that could melt down in such an attack for sure. It's the pools of high-level radioactive waste storage that are not in radiological containment. They're in industrial warehouse-type buildings that could unleash mega catastrophes if they lose their cooling water. So case in point, Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4, the Japanese prime minister at the time had a secret contingency plan in the works that if that pool went up in flames, and it almost did, was through sheer luck that it didn't. He was planning to evacuate 35 to 50 million people from Metro Tokyo and Northeast Japan because of the radioactive releases that would have happened. And he said it would have been the end of the Japanese state.
And we should pay more just to keep that threat going and hope that no terrorist blows it up or they don't have an accident or the top of it doesn't melt through or the... It's terrible. It's a terrible situation. So now, Kevin, it's time to let you out of the box on your favorite nuclear power plant. Go ahead and tell us about your roots with the Palisades Nuclear Generating Station.
Yeah, I had worked on nuclear weapons before in a younger day, but then when I returned home, I learned of Palisades, which I hadn't known about growing up in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's, again, as I said about Davis Bessey, Palisades is one of the riskiest nuclear power plants in the United States. It is the most embrittled reactor pressure vessel in the United States, with a close second over at Point Beach, Wisconsin, right across Lake Michigan. So poor Lake Michigan is wedged between the two most embrittled pressurized water reactors in the United States. And what it means is if they ever activate the emergency core cooling systems at either of those reactors, it could be like a hot glass under cold water, only under 2,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. That's a pressurized water reactor. And they could fracture through wall the reactor pressure vessel. And if that happens, there is no contingency to prevent the core meltdown. The last line of defense is going to be the containment to try to keep it bottled up and not get out. But as we've discussed, containments sometimes fail. And at Fukushima Daiichi, we saw catastrophic failure of containment. So that's one risk going on at Palisades. There are many others. They've never replaced or repaired the reactor lid, even post Davis Bessey's near miss because of a corroded reactor lid. So Palisades has reactor pressure vessel embrittlement. It has reactor lid corrosion. It has steam generator degradation. These are all pathways to meltdown. We really tried hard in 2006 to prevent the license extension at Palisades from 2011 to 2031. NRC rubber stamped it anyway, despite all these risks. And most recently, and heartbreakingly, Palisades had announced a closure date of October 1st, 2018. And because of these bait and switches in New York and Illinois, announced closures that were just used as leverage to win bailouts, we were very skeptical from the start. And sure enough, last September, they said, you know what, we've changed our mind. We're not shutting down. We're going to keep going at least until 2022. They're gouging ratepayers near Palisades under a exorbitant power purchase agreement. And if they want to, if they can orchestrate another power purchase agreement to extend that out to 2031, they have NRC's blessing to just keep going. Palisades should have been shut down a very long time ago, and they are just sailing ever deeper into uncharted risk territory.
The motto at NRC, run them until they blow. How can people find out more about your organization so we really can go beyond nuclear?
Yeah, our website is just www.beyondnuclear.org, and there is a lot there, so just pursue your interests.
We've been speaking with Kevin Camp from Beyond Nuclear, and I will put links to this interview, a bunch of supporting materials, and Kevin's other appearances on Radio EcoShock, all in my own show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We didn't even get time to talk about the Russian hacking of the nuclear power stations. As revealed in a recent government report, they can turn them off and on, and the news media pretended an adversary would just shut down the reactors, causing a power blackout. Well, that's a big problem, but that's the best-case scenario. Really, as Kevin told me, they could just shut down the safety systems, causing a massive nuclear accident or many of them, like Fukushima. There's another reason to shut down these dangerous old reactors as fast as we can, but no, the government wants to run them until they blow, no matter what the cost to American taxpayers and ratepayers. Okay, let's get to some breaking climate science.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
If you are listening, you are probably a land mammal. So as the world warms abnormally, you want to know whether to prepare for drought, floods, or extreme weather. Scientists model the atmosphere, the soil, and the seas, but new research reveals a surprise. One determining factor is alive, the reaction of plants to more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it's not what you've heard about. This breaking science comes from the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in a paper published April 2, 2018. The title is Critical Impact of Vegetation Physiology on the Continental Hydrologic Cycle in Response to Increasing CO2, and we'll parse out what that means with our guest, a co-author of the paper. Professor Pierre Gentin heads the Gentin Lab at Columbia Engineering and Earth Institute in New York City. Dr. Gentin is currently on sabbatical at ETH Zurich University in Switzerland. From Zurich, Pierre Gentin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Most of the climate science I deal with talks about greenhouse gases, the state of the ice world, ocean currents, and all that. And from that data, scientists model out the impact of climate changes on agriculture and wild plants. What made you think plants have a more direct role?
Our thinking is that plants are going to regulate whether or not we live in a drier or wetter place, basically. So the idea is that we typically think in terms of either we will have more supply, so more precipitation or snowfall. And so that's typically what we think will provide most of the moisture. And then we have whatever demand we typically get from the atmosphere. So if you have higher temperature, typically you expect to have more demand. So we typically think in terms of either more supply or more demand. And this balance will basically define whether we will live in a drier or wetter world. And what we found is that, in fact, the main regulator of the water cycle and basically of water stress or drying as we go into the future are going to be plants. And the reason for that is that they strongly regulate the water cycle as they basically pick up carbon and take up carbon from the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So as you increase carbon dioxide, what happens is that plants are typically fine, and so they tend to regulate or close what we call the stomata, which are really small openings that are at the tip of the leaves or at the end of the leaves. And what it does is that basically they will close their stomata and they will regulate how much they will be transpiring, so how much water is going to flow from the roots to the atmosphere through the leaves. And as a result, because you have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you will have less typically transpiration. So you would have less flow of water from the roots to the atmosphere. The models, what we found is that what will happen in the future is that this is going to really impact how we actually perceive and how we actually assess droughts and floods as well. And so plants will be the primary regulator of this drying or wetting mechanism.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because I had some doubts about a statement in the press release from Columbia, and that was attributed to the lead author and the PhD student in your lab, Leo Lemordin. And it says, plants are really the thermostat of the world, but I don't think that's really what he meant, because Richard Alley from Penn State famously said, carbon dioxide is the thermostat of the world. What do you think Leo meant?
Yeah, what he meant is not thermostat in terms of temperature, but what he meant was really thermostat in terms of regulator. That's all. I mean, it wasn't really in terms of, maybe the analogy wasn't great, but it wasn't meaning in terms of temperature. It was really meaning in terms of regulator. So basically, plants are going to adjust whether or not we will be seeing a drier world. That's what he meant by thermostat.
All right, fair enough. Now, our listeners have heard about feedback loops with things like sea ice disappearing or methane. Talk to us about the feedback loops coming from vegetation.
There are many feedbacks, but to me, the primary one is really between the carbon and water cycle. So one of the biggest unknown in carbon uptake is really related to land carbon uptake, way more than the ocean. I mean, ocean carbon uptake is relatively well-defined, I would say. The land carbon uptake is very, very unknown, and the predictions are pretty uncertain. And most of that is actually related to this coupling between the carbon dioxide cycle and the water cycle at the land surface. And that's, again, related to how plants are going to adjust. So to give you an example is that imagine plants are regulating because you're providing more carbon dioxide. So now they basically feel happier and they want to close partly, I mean, not entirely, but they want to close their stomata. So they want to close
some of the opening getting from the roots to the atmosphere. So they are regulating the flow of water and basically evaporation from the roots to the atmosphere. As a result, what's going to change is the amount of moisture you have in the soil. So imagine that now you have more moisture. And so that's going to have also an impact on the evaporation, you know, like salt evaporation, also transpiration from plants. And so basically those two are really, I mean, you have a very strong feedback mechanism between the two. So you increase carbon dioxide, and as a result, you're very strongly modifying the water cycle. But when you're changing the water cycle, it also has really dramatic impact on the carbon cycle. So it's been shown, for instance, during El Nino, it's pretty well known that we have systematic CO2 source to the atmosphere from most of the tropical land regions. And so we know that when we get into a drought or when we get into a warmer than usual summer or warmer than usual tropical land, we tend to have way more CO2 source to the atmosphere. So it means that those two cycles are very, very tightly coupled. And actually, in my lab, we are trying to use remote sensing data to actually get a sense of what is this coupling and how does it work and how well are we representing that in models.
For me, this is a bit of strange talk because I've always been told that as the earth warms, the lands will get drier, and yet it looks like the plants might delay that or the soils might actually become wetter.
So that thinking, and actually I'm using that a lot, you know, in my talks and stuff, that thinking I think is actually pretty incorrect. I mean, there's a couple of regions where we have this so-called dry get drier, wet get wetter mechanism. So there's a couple of places like the Mediterranean, South Africa, or Central America, where we kind of know that we expect that those places are going to be drier. But many other places, I would say, it's not that clear. And in fact, the fact that it's so complicated is actually very much related to plants. So if plants were to behave and become very greedy, you know, they would basically pump a lot of water. But many of them tend to be a little bit more conservative, you know. So meaning that they might not be as greedy as, and so they might limit the amount of moisture they are picking up in the soil. And so, for instance, we are seeing things that are a little bit abnormal. So, for instance, in the southwestern U.S., we are seeing a greening. So you see more green plants than before. But you're seeing, if you were to measure the amount of moisture in the soil, you're actually seeing a drying. So you can have a greening and at the same time a drying as well. So it's not the typical thinking of just drying that will be just bone dry like a desert, but you could have actually more plants because you have more carbon dioxide. So you're basically feeding them. And at the same time, you could have a soil that's a little bit drier. So I think that will be mostly what will happen in many regions.
Do you think there's a level of carbon dioxide where this plant reaction becomes even more pronounced, like at 600 parts per million CO2 or 800 ppm?
Yeah, we are starting to see already that happening right now. I mean, a lot of it's already, I mean, that's basically what I mentioned. I mean, you can look at, for instance, the southwest U.S. and you can actually look and see those changes, you know. But I think above 600 ppm is going to be a game changer for many of those processes.
If leaf level water use efficiency increases, as you say in the paper, when there's more CO2 in the air, is it possible some plants can live with less rainfall, maybe even become more drought tolerant?
Yes, definitely possible, yeah. Yeah, so that's basically the example I was giving in the southwest U.S. So you're increasing this basically drought tolerance. And people are also trying to modify plants. So, for instance, they are using or trying to mimic. So you have this so-called CAM, C-A-M type of photosynthesis. So basically that's how cacti are actually working. And so people are trying to see if we could actually mimic some of that to get that drought tolerance trait. So that could be a way. C4 plants are also pretty well adapted to dry conditions as well. The main point is that we are expecting to get some increase in water use efficiency. I mean, that's the typical thinking. So in a sense, you could say that plants are not that greedy in a sense. They are relatively happy, and carbon is not the main limitation. There are other limitations like nutrients, for instance.
Right. So, Pierre Gentin, you co-authored a paper published in May 2017 titled Regionally Strong Feedbacks Between the Atmosphere and Terrestrial Biosphere. Is it important to understand regional feedbacks if we want to look at the whole climate future?
Yes. I mean, one of the key things is that when we talk about warming, imagine, like, for instance, if you think about the Paris Agreement, we typically mention a global warming. So let's say 2 degrees Celsius. You know, the trouble will be that land regions have very little inertia. compared to the ocean, because water is the element on the planet that has the biggest inertia. So what it means is that the ocean will warm up much, much slower than land regions. And so what will typically happen is that dry regions in particular are going to be way warmer than those 2 degrees, meaning that the regional impact is going to be way more dramatic, especially over dry regions compared to the global 2 degree average. So if you're looking at a dry region, you could have 4 or 5 degrees, depending. Especially if you start looking at extremes like heat waves, you will see very, very dramatic impact on land regions at a very regional scale, especially, again, in those dry regions.
Last fall, we heard from our Russian guest scientist Anastasia Makareva, and her work suggests that large forests, whether in the Amazon or the boreal, develop airflows and encourage their own weather systems that bring rain all the way from the oceans. What are your thoughts on that?
So I'm actually working on those things. So I think it's actually happening in one part of the Amazon, which is to the west, so closest to Colombia, basically. And that's where you're basically seeing some increase in rainfall, even if you look at the long-term record. But if you start looking to the east, we are seeing basically a drying. So in the Amazon, this dry get drier, wet get wetter type of mechanism tends to apply, even though, but it basically tends to apply. So we tend to see wetter regions that are already wet and drier regions that are already dry, even though, I mean, you can have some regional discrepancies as well. And I would mention that one thing that seems to be altering a lot the story in the Amazon is also land use and cover change. So the fact that we are deforesting there, we're changing the landscape a lot. So that has implications for many things.
Yes, you've said in your paper that the type of vegetation on the land matters a lot. And as we speak, Indonesia and other countries are cutting down dense tropical rainforests to replace them with palm oil plantations. That also would have an impact on regional hydrology, wouldn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one example is if you look at Costa Rica, for instance, they are growing a lot of pineapples there. And pineapples tends to actually be way warmer during the day. So that has actually pretty strong impact, especially in terms of regional temperature. So there's a strong warming, actually. You can see that in Costa Rica during the day, at least. So, yeah, definitely. And that's the same in the Amazon. You can use that. You can look at land cover change and deforestation, and that has pretty dramatic impact in terms of the temperature change. Again, at the regional scale, not global, but mostly regional.
Yes. So if you continue the direction of your research, could it help farmers and governments make long-term plans about what crops to plant?
Yes, we are actually collaborating with a couple of people on the sociological impact and trying to see how we could maybe inform basically agricultural farming, especially in tropical regions, and seeing what is the impact that we have across scale. So basically at a very small scale, and what's the regional impact, and when we start for instance, deforesting at a relatively big scale, and what's the impact on climate, what's the impact on water, and what's the impact on nutrients.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Professor Pierre Gentin, head of the Gentin Lab at Columbia Engineering and Earth Institute in New York City, but we've reached Pierre in Switzerland. In your paper, what do you mean by continental water stress?
So we mean drying or wetting, but there are many definitions. So that's why we're mentioning continental water stress, because one stress could be a low amount of moisture in the soil. So that's one definition. The other definition would be you want to know if your plants are stressed. So that would be another definition if you're a farmer, for instance. Another definition could be I want to look at runoff. If I'm in, for instance, I'm looking at water resource management or like a catchment hydrologist or something. So what we meant is that you can have many different definitions of drying or stress, you know, but those definitions are not always the same. So for instance, the example I gave before, you could have greening. So if you're a farmer, you're happy because you could have, for instance, more yield. But at the same time, you could have a soil that's drier. So you could have things that are a little bit more divergent than what we have right now. And I think that's what is interesting, or at least from a scientific standpoint, with rising CO2, is that some of the definitions of a drought or what is the definition of water stress is going to change somehow. And those definitions are going to be a little bit more divergent somehow. And that's pretty unusual compared to looking at historical records.
Now, the press release from Columbia says your team is, quote, the first to isolate the response of vegetation from the global warming total complex response. For the layperson, Pierre, can you explain what tools your team used to tease out this plant response from the bigger warming picture?
So what we used Earth system models, so those simulations are basically out there. So that's not new, I would say. What's new is the way we actually decompose. So we try to actually quantify in those simulations what is the actual contribution of vegetation. Whereas typically people were looking at the overall response. So they were looking at what is the contribution of everything, including the increase in radiation, the increase in temperature, the change in precipitation, and the impact of vegetation that they typically thought was small. And what we found out was that vegetation had the biggest impact in the end, way more than precipitation and way more than radiation.
And when you say that vegetation will play the determining role or a determining role in controlling the future water cycle on land, that begins to sound a little bit like the original hypothesis from James Lovelock that plants shape their environment to fit their needs. What do you think?
Yeah, actually, that's true, yeah. Yeah, in the end, plants are going to regulate, I mean, to some extent to what they need, you know. I tend to think of them as being not really greedy. So they try to basically adjust to basically what their needs are somehow. And because we are going to provide way more carbon dioxide, so basically we're providing way more food for them. One thing that I should mention is that one thing that's very uncertain is the role of nutrients. So that's one thing that's very uncertain as well, is that how are nutrients going to limit these carbon uptake as well? So that's a big, big unknown.
And of course, marine experts say the real drama of climate change will play out on the oceans, which are much larger than the land base. Do you have a sense of the balance between the terrestrial ecosphere that you study and the biosphere and the physics of the seas when it comes to climate change?
Yeah, so the ocean is basically picking up more CO2 from the atmosphere, but there's way more unknown in terms of carbon uptake from land. So that's why it's a very big source of uncertainty in current Earth system models. And one of the reasons is basically what I mentioned, is coupling between the water and carbon cycle, which is poorly understood. So that's why we can use new tools like remote sensing to constrain that better. And there's also like all of the nutrients that are going to limit this uptake as well. So that's also a big unknown.
But I know as a gardener, there are points where the heat is just too much for the plants. And I wonder, isn't there also a point where global heating just overwhelms the existing vegetation, possibly leading to deserts?
Yeah, some people are always thinking about it. So there's always this idea, especially in ecology, of tipping point, you know, that if there would be like a given temperature above which there would be a tipping point. I hope to be more optimistic, so I hope that there's no tipping point and that basically plants will be sufficiently plastic and they will adjust somehow. We'll see, yeah, but I hope they're able to adjust somehow.
And Pierre Gentil, you're thinking about doing some research into the implications of extreme heat wave events?
Yes, so we have a couple of papers actually in reviews looking at exactly at those things. So looking at how plants are regulating extremes and how they are also interacting with extremes, yeah.
Negotiators at Paris tried to set 1.5 degrees warming as the safe zone, but we're already touching on that. And now it's 2 degrees C warming as the red line we should not cross. But those numbers are kind of based on human needs. It almost sounds like there's a different scale of danger for the plant world.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. And also for humans, again, as I was mentioning before, I think there's this big difference between, I mean, 1.5 or 2 degrees relatively abstract because that's a global average temperature. But typically what you'll see is that over land, it's going to be way warmer than that. And especially extremes and heat waves are going to be way more impactful than before.
We've been talking about a breakthrough paper on the interaction between climate, the atmosphere, and plant life on land below. The title is Critical Impact of Vegetation Physiology on the Continental Hydrologic Cycle in Response to Increasing CO2. The paper was published April 2nd, 2018 in PNAS. Find links to Pierre's work and the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pierre, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's the whole truth from Radio EcoShock this week. You can always post your comments in my show blog at ecoshock.org or write me, radio@ecoshock.org. As always, thank you for listening and caring about our world.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
In a way or another, every Palestinian gathering there was a target.
Gaza specifically is still bleeding from everything that it had been through.
Discrimination is only addressed by universities once it's actually challenged by people.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Away from the fence. As you see, we can see the Israeli army snipers, we can see the Israeli army soldiers in the jeeps and trying to target all the protesters that are being very close to the fence by live ammunition, rubber bullets, and the tear gas canisters. They are using new, updated, and developed weapons. As you see, this is the tear gas by the drone, by the Israeli army. They are using the drone to throw the tear gas canisters on the protesters. And this is like the 10th time they're using it since the beginning of the day today. Here's a live injury just right now from the tear gas canisters that were thrown on the protesters just right now. And as you see, everyone is trying to take this injury to the ambulance to go to the hospital directly.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. That was reporter Hind Khoudary reporting from the Gaza Strip for RT News last Friday, March 30th, during the Great March of Return. According to the latest figures, the death toll from that day has now risen to 18, the bloodiest single day for Palestinians since Israel's 2014 assault on Gaza. These include 14 Palestinians killed when Israeli forces opened fire on thousands of people taking part in rallies along the Gaza-Israel boundary, protesting Israel's siege of the territory and demanding the right for refugees to return to lands from which they were expelled by Israel. Approximately 1,400 people were injured, including around 800 hit with live ammunition. On April 2nd, an additional protester died from injuries sustained during the demonstrations. The first killing on March 30th was of Omar Samur, a farmer tending his field at dawn. The same day, two Palestinian resistance fighters were killed in a separate incident in the north of Gaza, away from the protest rallies. The Israeli army posted a statement on Twitter the day after the march, apparently accepting full responsibility for the killings. The army then quickly deleted the admission as more evidence of war crimes by its soldiers came to light, but not before a copy was made by the human rights group B'Tselem. The now-deleted tweet from the official at IDF spokesperson account stated, quote, "Yesterday we saw 30,000 people. We arrived prepared and with precise reinforcements. Nothing was carried out uncontrolled. Everything was accurate and measured, and we know where every bullet landed." Human Rights Watch issued a report on Tuesday concluding that Israel's violence against Palestinians was premeditated, illegal under international law, and ordered at the highest level. And Israel has presented no evidence whatsoever of any credible threat that would justify the violence it used on that day. Joining us to talk about what they saw that day and continue to see in Gaza are two special guests, writers and activists Rifat Alarir and Rawan Yagi. Rawan's op-ed, "Gaza Screams for Life," was just published in the New York Times, of all places. And Rifat is a professor and a contributor to the Electronic Intifada. Rawan's writing was featured in the anthology Gaza Writes Back, which Rifat co-edited. Rifat and Rawan, it's so good to have you both with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for
great
having
to
us.
Be here.
So, Rifat, let's start with you. You were there on Friday, March 30th, at the Great March of Return, as thousands of Palestinians marched near the eastern boundary with Israel to demand their right of return and an end to the decade-long Israeli siege. You took lots of photos and videos that day and posted many of them on your Twitter account, at This Is Gaza. Tell us about that day, what it felt like, what it looked like at the march. How did that day begin?
The day began actually after a couple of months, or probably close to a month of preparations, where people, activists, were calling for a peaceful march in Gaza. At the beginning, it wasn't clear how things will end up. But on Friday, as I took a taxi with my wife and my kids and headed to the eastern parts of Gaza City itself, near where my family lives, near where I used to live before Israel destroyed our house. And there were, I would say, actually, hundreds of thousands of people. Like, the whole area was crowded. There were people gathering, families, kids, elderly men, elderly women, like it seemed like everyone in Gaza City was heading toward the borders in anticipation of what's going to happen. The whole day started with people gathering, and then there was the Friday prayer, and more people kept coming throughout the whole day. It was so emotional. It was so emotional in the sense that many people were never this close to their own villages and towns that Israel destroyed and depopulated decades ago. I saw elderly women almost weeping and shedding tears because they were so happy, so in a sense that they thought that they were returning back to their homes, that they were finally going to go back to the homes they left behind because Israeli militias and the Zionist gangs kicked them out by force, and only to be met with bullets, only to be met with drones throwing tear gas canisters. The day, in my opinion, was unprecedented in the sense that there were Palestinians belonging to all political factions. This was not a political march. It was a popular march. Hamas did not lead this. But naturally, Hamas, Fatah, Islamic Jihad, and leftist factions were all there. People who didn't belong to any political party were also there because, again, like you said, everyone was calling for an end to this occupation, an end to this medieval siege imposed on Gazans here in Palestine, hoping for a better future, hoping for a better life.
Rifat, can you tell us a little bit more about what it was like there at the march, the mood, the maybe some of the signs that people were holding, some of the conversations that you had with people, and how long did it take until Israeli snipers started to shoot into the crowd?
The major theme there, it was a festival. Like, again, many people brought their food, the kids brought their toys. They were dressed. They tried to look their best. Everyone, the mood was festival, was cheerful. It was like a celebration. It was like Palestine is free and people are finally returning back. This was the major theme, the major mood. And most of the slogans were focusing on the right of return, Palestinians, because the majority of Palestinians living in Gaza Strip are refugees. They have their own land. Even I'm not a refugee myself, but my grandparents on both parts of my parents own land beyond this Israeli a border imposed around Gaza, because this is only part of Gaza. There's something called Greater Gaza. So my father could point to areas where my grandparents would plow and plant and live for years before Israel occupied Palestine and Gaza Strip. So this was the major theme. There was hope. There was festivity, like there was festivities, it was some kind of celebration, unprecedented, because everyone was participating. Now, the actual killing started, like you said in the introduction, it started at dawn. There was a farmer in Khan Yunis who was shot and killed, was killed by Israel. And in the Gaza City point of gathering near the border, even before the Friday prayer, where people started gathering by hundreds and thousands, we would every now and then hear the ambulance coming and taking injured people, whether by live round or by tear gas. So I can't tell exactly when the shooting started in the Gaza City, but it started as early as people started to gather, and even before people threw stones or whatever they had at the Israeli snipers shooting at Palestinians.
That's the voice of Rifat Al-Arir speaking to us from Gaza. Rifat, when Israel started shooting into the crowd, when the high-tech drone started dropping tear gas on these massive crowds of people, how did the mood shift? What did you see?
After the Friday prayer, I ventured closer and closer with some friends, and I realized that there were a lot more people there than we were at the back, because the whole area was crowded. Like I said, one friend estimated over 150,000 people only in Gaza Strip, in Gaza City itself. So we couldn't make calls, and I tweeted about this. We couldn't make calls. I wasn't sure whether this is because there were so many people crowding the area or because Israel did something. I'm not sure. I can't tell. So we were cut off. We didn't have internet connection. We couldn't call friends or family. We couldn't listen to the news. So many people there were not aware of the fact that Israel was shooting and sniping Palestinian protesters. And this is something that many people didn't realize. Even when I came close, like 300 meters away from the borders, and I was there and I saw two or three people shot. Many people suffered like inhalation problems because of the tear gas. And I didn't realize that many people were shot. It was later on when I went back to upload the photos and the videos I took, I heard in the news that at least seven people were killed. I was personally stunned because the guys were far away, no stone. And I tweeted also about this. I said, not even David's sling could get the stones over the border. So Israel, on purpose, and we've seen this in their tweets, in their Facebook, the Israeli officials were tweeting about this and were stating that openly, that they will shoot at any Palestinian that approaches. And in a way or another, every Palestinian gathering there was a target. So if Israel meant to send people away by shooting them, as a matter of fact, people kept coming and coming and coming. And this is a very strong message that people were sending, that even if you're killing us, even if you're shooting us, we're not going to retreat. We're not going back. We're not going to go down. We're not going to submit. We're not going to kneel. Israel has been brutalizing Palestinians for seven decades. And it's not going to be that much if, Israel, we don't expect Israel to stop shooting at any time soon, unless there is a lot of pressure. So the shooting did not prevent people from coming to where to the gathering, did not send people, did not terrorize or frighten people, because we had a message of our rights. We have our rights to call for this struggle. The march itself was peaceful, was nonviolent, and people were insisting on this, raising their voices that we will remain here We don't expect, of course, Israel to open the borders and to tell people to go back. Israel has to be forced to do this. But the message was that Palestinians will keep struggling for their rights. We will keep resisting the Israeli occupation by all means available.
I want to bring Rowan Yagi into this. Rowan, you weren't at the march last Friday, but you did attend a rally on Sunday as part of the planned 6 weeks of protests and actions by people in Gaza up until Nakba Day, May 15th, which commemorates 70 years now of expulsion, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid. Rowan, you actually managed to get an op-ed published in the New York Times, which has been calling Israel's premeditated murder of Palestinians last Friday as merely, quote, clashes. We can spend an entire broadcast talking about the ways in which the Times and other mainstream media outlets continue to toe Israel's line and deliberately obscure Israel's crimes against humanity. But I want you to talk about what you saw on Sunday, what that protest looked like, and what the mood was 3 days after all of these people had been killed during the Great March of Return.
So, yeah, I went to the march on Sunday. There were a few hundred people there. It was actually surprising to see just that many people, given I went almost at midday, because it was really hot. And the crowd was initially quiet. It was very silent until a few women started singing the Abu Arab song, Raja. It was really, it was a really nice spirit, a spirit of togetherness, a spirit of hope, and people just stood there, sometimes singing, sometimes chanting, and they didn't seem to want to provoke anything. They could see all of the snipers hiding behind the sand barriers just across from the border. They were about 200 meters away from the fence, and I think the fence was about 100 meters from the sand barriers of the soldier, the snipers. Like I said in the article, people didn't go closer than that to the fence. There were people asking them not to, and didn't seem to me like people wanted to go closer, because it just didn't seem like an appealing idea to anyone. There were a few shots of live ammunition, and that was terrifying because all of these people were standing in daylight, in perfect view of the snipers. Any of them could have been taken down at any moment. And I was amazed by these people's courage to stand there. Yeah, it was scary as well, because you knew that there was live ammunition at play, and there wasn't any fear from the sniper's side to use that force. There was a little bit of tension, but the people who were standing there were also full of life. But the more striking thing was that there were people who had been injured on Friday, protesting again. There were people who had hand injuries, some of the people playing football had their hands wrapped. You could actually see the blood on the wrap. I remember asking them, "You have the whole of Gaza Strip to play football. What are you doing here?" And they said, "Because this is a way to protest as well. We want to play football on the border. It's a nice open space to play here as well. Why not play here?" Because they do. They have the right to play anywhere they want in Gaza, and they shouldn't be afraid of bullets, of the threat of being killed just for playing or just for protesting or just for demanding whether the right of return or a basic right of living, really. That was, I thought that people who had been injured on Friday coming back to the protests or the march to be the most striking thing. And it just made sense looking at the whole picture of Gaza, because Gaza has been injured or has been wronged over and over again over the past, not just decade, but over the past 7 decades since the Nakba. Gaza and all of Palestine have been wronged and have been injured, but Gaza specifically is still bleeding from everything that it had been through, and it's still out there, still calling for rights that others choose to overlook, that the world chooses to overlook. The right of return, the right for life, the right for safety, the right for playing football, for protest, for free speech, for everything, really.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
It also has to be true that we see the whole world as sacred. Why would one place be more important than another? That when we lose track of the fact that all of the world should be sacred in that bigger sense, then we're in trouble. Because when we start to designate some places as important and sacred and other places as not important, then inevitably we do greater damage to those places we've deemed not sacred.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen regarding his latest book, Plain Radical: Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully. Stay tuned.
We are live with Dr. Robert Jensen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thinking about the world and the crises that we face are multiple. You know, we face an economic crisis, an ecological crisis, a social and political ramifications of living in the world that is mired with hierarchies. How do we engage in the world in a way that allows us to live more gracefully, recognizing our interconnection with one another?
Well, that's a great struggle that people have always had to deal with who have a critique of the way systems, big systems of power, work in the world. And I think the answer is that we all find a balance between the amount of time, energy we commit to challenging illegitimate authority, challenging systems of power like white supremacy and patriarchy and capitalism, and how much we try to construct at the level of our day-to-day life a sane and decent community where we think about reducing our consumption and treating both, you know, the human and non-human world more gently. And different people will strike that balance in different ways. But I think as long as we hold both of those goals in mind, the need to challenge power and the need to live decent lives, whatever the balance we accomplish can contribute to the possibility of a better world.
In your latest book, Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Live the Planet Gracefully, you write about your friend Jim Copeland and about the lessons that you learned from him as to how do we navigate this world of, at times what seems to be counter actions, and yet the importance of recognizing our situatedness and our interrelatedness to one another.
Right. Well, Jim Copeland is a name that people won't recognize unless they knew him personally, because he wasn't famous. He didn't write books. But he was a lifelong activist and had to deal with these questions starting in the 1960s through all of the important movements in the last half of the 20th century. And the first thing Jim would say is that the balance he struck in his life was not for everybody. Everybody should figure this out on their own. But he participated in movements. You know, he participated in the civil rights movement in the U.S., the anti-war movements. He dedicated a lot of his life to feminist movements. But he also tried to be part of decent communities on the ground level. He was a lifelong gardener, and he believed the skills that one cultivates in the garden are important. He contributed to community groups that were focused on the arts or on more social and cultural questions, believing that you have to build strong connections to human beings on the ground. And so the book is really an attempt to tell both the story of Jim and the philosophy behind how he made those decisions to help people who are struggling themselves come to their own conclusions about that.
You talk about the connection between our mind and our body, recognizing that we are, you know, above all things, living beings, just like, you know, all the other sentient beings that share the earth with us. How do we then locate the traces of colonization, of imperialism, that demarcate on our bodies the trauma, the terror that we are forced to live with at times?
It's crucial. And of course, in the modern, you know, high technology world, we're increasingly disembodied. Obviously, we still have bodies and still walk in the world. But take the obvious example of the proliferation of screens and how much of our understanding of the world comes through a screen, whether it's the computer or a smartphone or the movie screen or the television screen or the video game. You know, for many people, a real connection to the larger living world is largely mediated through screens. In effect, it's kind of disembodied. Now, I don't believe everybody has to go throw away their computers, but recognizing that even for those of us living fairly privileged lives, this question of the body is very important. How do we stay connected to that larger living world? And my friend Jim, you know, was a big believer that that was crucial to progressive politics. As I said, he connected to the world in a really profound way through gardening. You know, he'd grown up on a farm, and his body and its connection to the dirt was very important to him. Of course, in other situations, these questions of the body are much more distressing when we think about, you know, the violence of patriarchy and how that's visited upon primarily women's bodies. The struggle to achieve dignity in much of the third world because of the incredible imbalance in the distribution of wealth and power. There, the problems of the body are much more tangible and obvious. But, you know, these are questions that are meaningful for all of us, no matter where we live, in a sense.
I was thinking about the way you write your story is quite touching and very vulnerable, you know, in the way that you allow the reader to see you your most naked. And I think that there's a certain power in being this open, you know, with your story, with, you know, in the sharing of our stories, because as you point out in your book, most people tend to want to tell their story of how they succeeded, how their power makes them, you know, this unique or, you know, standalone kind of personality. I see the invitation as your reader as one that is a vulnerability, as one that invites me to engage in my own story as well. But I wonder, how do you see that story connecting to other stories?
Thank you for that comment, because that was an important part of the book for me. There are really two things I was trying to emphasize that I think are especially important for people like me who are academics or writers. You know, a lot of us who teach and write for a living, we tell a story, as you point out, that makes us look really good. Like, here are these great ideas we've come to, as if somehow we, you know, have magic gifts that allow us to do this. But in my case, the ideas I've been writing and teaching about for the last 30 years really formed in collaboration with this friend, Jim Coplin. And by writing about that, I was, you know, recognizing that none of us build our ideas alone, that these are all collaborative. In my case, there was a particularly important collaboration with this one person, but Jim would be the first to recognize that his own ideas came in similar fashion through this interaction with other people. So, you know, we don't do it alone is one lesson. And the vulnerability is a reminder that, you know, when we achieve some success in life, and I'm a, you know, professor at a big university, so I'm successful in some sense, it's easy to avoid talking about the ways we are broken and vulnerable and weak and afraid. And I think for people in those positions of authority to do that is especially important. And that was a big part of how I came to understand the world, was by, instead of trying to ignore my own pain and my own vulnerabilities, through this work with Jim Coplin, I was able to open up and see those as a source of not only suffering personally, but a source of insight that, you know, we don't learn about the world only through our brains and this sort of disembodied thinking. We learn about the world through our engagement with it. And inevitably, if we're human, that means not only triumph and success, it means suffering and pain. And so all of this is part of, you know, every human experience. And I was just trying to write honestly about it, recognizing that I have this incredible privilege at this point in my life. I'm older, I'm established, I have the ability to write books. And I wanted to write as honestly as I could. I don't need to write a book in which I'm the hero. I think too often all of us tell stories when we're trying to make ourselves out to be the hero. And, you know, there are real heroes in the world, I suppose, but I don't feel like one of them.
I love that you not only speak about the courage to live and be open and vulnerable in order to be touched by the world and to touch the world at the same time, but you also invite us to embrace, you know, the pain, the suffering as one of our portals, perhaps, to our own greatness. Because you describe how your friend Jim refused to allow people to just skip, you know, the sadness, or when something became so hard, you know, too hard to bear, he would not let you just skip out of it, but rather engage you and invite you to sit with it and to discover what was in it. What were some of the gifts that you discover in those encounters?
Well, I think it's when we, you know, not only allow ourselves to feel sad. My friend Coplin would have said that sadness isn't really enough of a descriptor. He often talked about grief, especially when talking about the state of nature, the larger living world of which we're a part, in which we are slowly and increasingly rapidly destroying. And Jim used to make sure that people were willing in his world to sit with that grief, to engage it, because out of that grief, out of that recognition of just how much damage we've done to the world and to each other, we do come to new insights about how we might change, you know, a deeper moral reckoning. And I don't think you get to that place without the grief. Now, we live in a culture in which there's a lot of people trying to sell us perpetual happiness, you know, whether it's happiness through drugs or happiness through entertainment or whatever it might be. You know, this is a culture that doesn't want us to feel grief for the simple reason that when people are grieving, they don't tend to spend a lot of money. And so in a mass consumption culture, you know, with all this energy and technology around us, there are a lot of easy ways to dodge the grief. And my friend Copland simply wouldn't allow that in his own life. And to be his friend was to recognize you would have to reckon with that grief to stay in relationship to him. And that was probably the greatest gift he gave me and many other people as well. I had a very close and special relationship with Jim, but Jim had networks of people that over the 79 years of his life he had affected this way. And I think if we were all in a room and said, you know, what was special about Jim Copland, there'd be a lot of things, but what would bind us would be the honesty with which Jim was able to look reality straight on and feel what comes from that, that sadness, that grief, and also balanced, of course, with joy. Human life is not just grief, it's also joy. And it's kind of a common theme in poetry and the arts that if you deny your capacity to grieve, you will also implicitly be restricting your ability to feel joy. And Jim Copland really took that to heart and really understood what that meant, I think.
I love your poem. In the book, you quote Wendell Berry and you say, "It is hard to have hope. It is harder as you grow old, for hope must not depend on feeling good. And there is the dream of loneliness and absolute midnight. You also have withdrawn belief in the present reality of the future, which surely would surprise us. And hope is harder when it cannot come by prediction any more than by wishing. But stop dithering," I love this, "the young as the old to hope. What will you tell them? Tell them at least what you said to yourself."
You can never go wrong quoting Wendell Berry, in a sense. His poetry is very powerful in that way. And what was so important to me about that passage was that often people who recognize, for instance, we face these multiple ecological crises, who have some sense themselves of the depth of the problems, they'll say, well, people can't handle that, as if somehow you can know something and it's appropriate not to speak honestly of it to others. And so that, you know, that idea, say at least what you say to yourself, is very important, to not let the fear of how other people will react keep you from talking honestly about what you know. And again, Jim Copland was a real model for that. He didn't go around imposing his views on everybody, but when people did engage him in conversation, he always spoke honestly. He told others what he told himself and wasn't afraid to do that.
We live in a world that is constantly presenting us with recipes, you know, recipes for the, you know, the way to grow the economy, the way to become an academic, the way to do research. There's all kinds of templates that we're being offered. And I guess in so many ways, I have been consumed with this idea that we need a vision of a world that is interconnected, that is intergenerative, you know, that is constantly aware of our own presence with each other and the way we presence, you know, those with us. So how do you see us building a movement that is systematically intentional in a path of justice, in a path of ecological interconnectedness, and gracefully walking upon the earth in a way that allows many generations, long after we've gone, to be able to thrive and continue to exist and live in this planet?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that focus on interdependence is incredibly crucial. You know, we live in a culture, again, in the contemporary United States especially, but to some degree the developed world more generally, that obsesses about independence. In the U.S., you know, we're constantly talking about liberty and freedom, yet everyone understands at some level that there's no meaningful human life if you are truly disconnected from other people, that we are interdependent by nature. That's the kind of animals we are. And then the next step, of course, is to realize that interdependence is also with the non-human world, and that the modern culture, especially the mass consumption culture of the first world, disconnects us from other people and disconnects us from the larger world. So I guess the answer to the question, how do we do that, is first of all to recognize how the dominant culture tries to keep us from that recognition. And from there, people will have different solutions. For instance, just take a look at the rise of urban gardening in the United States and beyond. A huge explosion in the number of people who want to not only garden, but garden with other people, community gardens. Okay, well, that's a recognition that we have a connection to the earth, whether we, you know, we're raised that way or not, because our food comes from the earth, most obviously, and that producing food with our own hands is incredibly rewarding, especially when it's done communally. Now, you know, for most of human history, that's the way people did things, communally in a sustainable fashion with the larger living world. We didn't have to be taught how to do it. We didn't have to have programs in it, because for most of human history, that was just how we lived. But recent human history, especially the last 10,000 years, especially the last 200 years, have really kept us from, you know, what is our nature in a sense. And so I think a lot of these things you see are people's attempts to get back to what feels right. And what feels right is to be in a loving connection to other people in a way that doesn't demand we destroy the earth. And people will find different ways to do that, whether it's, you know, making sure you get time to get out of the city and spend some time, you know, walking on a trail on the edge of town. Maybe it's an hour a week of getting closer to, you know, the world without a screen in between you and that world is part of this process. And I think that's, in a sense, where the action is politically, trying to foster ways to bring people together like that, and especially together in ways that don't demand we destroy the earth.
I love that you point out that in your book that the sacred is everywhere, you know, and I think that I feel that when we connect with the earth, with everyone and everything, with a sense of sacredness, of, you know, honoring one another, there is but one place, you know, to be in, is one of co-creation, is one of, you know, reciprocity, is one where we are, you know, respectfully engaging with one another. But clearly, in a society that demarcates all our systems of, you know, of, I don't know, call it subsistence, as hierarchical structures where power and privilege cannot be ignored, how do we suspend those, you know, learned ideologies and ways of being to adopt a more sacred path of interconnection?
Maybe that's the big question, but let me go back. Something you said about the sacred got me thinking. You know, the sacred is a concept that's crucial in almost every culture. It can lead us to designate some spaces as particularly important. For instance, a temple, let's say, or in a church, can be seen as sacred space. And by that, we can mean that that's where we go to recharge. That's where we go to reflect, that we recognize a heightened sense of the sacred in that place. But at the same time, it also has to be true that we see the whole world as sacred. Why would one place be more important than another? That when we lose track of the fact that all of the world should be sacred in that bigger sense, then we're in trouble, because when we start to designate some places as important and sacred and other places as not important, then inevitably we do greater damage to those places we've deemed not sacred. You know, there's another line in the book I quote from Wendell Berry that really drives that home for me as part of a larger poem. He says, "There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places." And I think by that, Wendell Berry means we have to understand the whole world is part of this living earth. And it's all sacred in some sense. And it's only places that we humans have chosen to desecrate, to treat with less respect, that become, in a sense, waste, become unimportant. So if we think about it that way, then the toughest, you know, neighborhood in an urban setting that's all concrete and asphalt and broken bottles is every bit as much as sacred as a pristine mountaintop. It's all sacred because it's all part of the ecosphere. It's all part of this incredibly creative life force. And that's a move that's very important, away from thinking about life simply as a property of organisms. You're alive, Sylvia. I'm alive. The plant is alive. In some sense, that's obviously true. But in another sense, a bigger sense, we can think of the whole earth as being alive, that life is a property of the ecosphere. And that leads us to a different attitude, I think, and a different way of treating the earth. We're not as quick to describe some places as important and other places as garbage. Now, you keep going to the practical. How do you actually, you know, achieve that in the world? And again, some of it's about how we think differently, how we talk and come up with new ideas. But I think you're right that it's also about how we build that into our daily lives. Again, let me go back to my friend Jim and this renewed interest in gardening and in so many urban areas. When you garden, even if it's just planting a couple of tomato plants, right, it puts your hands into the soil. It reconnects you in a very foundational way to this larger living world. And I think that's a good example of that. Now, you know, everybody gardening isn't going to change the world because these structures of power are still there. But when we can reconnect to both the earth and to each other through these communal and collaborative practices, I think it builds our resilience to tackle these systems of power, which we should recognize aren't going away anytime soon. You know, the fact that you and I can agree capitalism is destructive, capitalism is incompatible with a sustainable human presence on the planet, doesn't mean capitalism is going away tomorrow. So we need to build the resilience to keep fighting, even though perhaps in our own lifetime we'll never achieve that victory. And the only way I know to do that is to recharge with other people and to recharge with the earth.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. I love your book, Plain Radical. It's just a very touching homage of what is clearly a very dear friend of yours. And I think with loss, we often get so mired in the grief that we lose the gift that life is a cycle. It's part of a cycle, you know, and we're all in that cycle of creating life and generating life. So in parting, what would you encourage our listeners? How would you encourage them to embrace this invitation? Because we are living in very difficult times, but within this hardship, there is an invitation, and, you know, that each and every one of us can take up.
My friend Jim Copland, who would be very embarrassed by all this conversation about him because he was a very quiet and humble person. I think what he would say is, first of all, start where you live. Look around. Who are your neighbors? What do they need? What can you do with them? You know, in the end, I think if we can't construct decent communities, if we can't be decent to each other, we don't have a lot of hope politically. And so the answer to that question is going to differ depending on who you are and where you live. For Jim, in addition to gardening, it was volunteering at a community arts project. It was, you know, going to the neighborhood cafe and you know, making sure there were fresh flowers from his garden in the vases because that beauty was important to him. It was about connecting to the people who had coffee in the morning at that cafe. It was all those little things that help create communities that enrich our lives instead of stress us out. And everybody will find different ways to do that. And the message Jim would leave us with is, don't use my life as a model. Don't try to replicate what I've done. Look around you and ask, what do you want to do yourself? And there you'll find the inspiration.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. How can our audience reach you? Find your books. How can they connect with your work?
If you put my name into a search engine, Robert Jensen, the first page that comes up will be my page, and there's an archive of material people can read for free and a list of books, a couple of which are also online for free, as well as an email address and phone number if anybody wants to get in touch.
Thank you again for being with us today.
Always great to be with you, Sylvia. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Winnie Madikizela Mandela, 1936-2018. She was born in 1936 and named Namzamo Winifred Madikizela. But the world would come to know this South African beauty as Winnie Mandela, the wife of African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela. Their lives, their struggles for freedom, dignity, and liberation from the racist ignominy known as apartheid, filled most of the 20th century. He, Nelson, labored under the eye of the harsh apartheid sun, breaking rocks in the prison yard, while she, Winnie, labored under the white state's total surveillance while she raised their children. While not widely known, her suffering included not only separation from her husband, but the cruel legality called banning, a South African censorship that outlawed her speech, not allowing her to quote her husband's words. Winnie, a lifelong rebel, ignored such law and proudly quoted Nelson, and she suffered her own imprisonment as well. She was banished to Bloemfontein, a white Afrikaner district, where the only blacks she saw were servants or cooks for white families. She continued to resist the racist government. The ANC was banned, and she wore the ANC colors as a headdress. And when, after Nelson's freedom, the marriage ended, she remained a powerful presence in South African life, loved by the nation's poor and dispossessed. For they knew in their heart of hearts that their struggle was her struggle. In her 1984 book, Part of My Soul Went With Him, Winnie Mandela wrote, "I have ceased a long time ago to exist as an individual. The ideals, the political goals that I stand for, Those are the ideals and goals of the people in this country. They cannot just forget their own ideals. My private self doesn't exist. Whatever they do to me, they do to the people of this country. Several years ago, when Nelson was being laid to rest, his third wife, Graça Machel Mandela, stumped in grief, was given a hug and a kiss to console her by his second wife, Winnie. Namzamo Winnie Mandela Madikizela, a class act to the very end, and a lifelong revolutionary. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Slave quarters use Bible stories to support their long struggle for freedom. In the long, dark night of bondage, people turned Bible stories into freedom songs, which were later called Negro spirituals, such as this example. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. And the walls came tumbling down. For African captives, largely illiterate, this song was a powerful prayer for black liberation that echoed down the corridors of history. In the mid-20th century, as young black folks joined the black liberation, the name Jericho retained its aura of freedom. For 20 years now, Jericho, once led by the remarkable revolutionary Sufukari, has been fighting for the freedom of black revolutionaries, veterans of the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, and other revolutionary formations. Bukhari, herself, a veteran leader in the Black Panther Party, a combatant in the Black Liberation Army, and a vice president in the Republic of New Africa, fought long and hard for freedom, political prisoners, and prisoners of war. It was said that she did the work of 10 people, and for those who knew Safia, surely this was an understatement. Safia, remembered and loved for her courage, hard work, and dedication to black freedom, is no more, but Jericho is still with us. And Jericho, the movement, is doing today what black captives have done for centuries, fight for freedom. The voices of chained African captives echo throughout time in sweet, tragic song, longing for freedom still. Joshua, the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Was Martin Luther King's assassination 50 years ago the result of a high-level conspiracy? Who was James Earl Ray, and what role did he play in the assassination? Who was Lloyd Jowers, and what role did he play in the plot to kill King? What motives did J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI have in seeking the death of the civil rights leader? Why would the media downplay, if not completely distort, the facts surrounding the assassination of Martin Luther King, even if members of the King family were critical of the official story? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the death of the famous civil rights leader, we spend the hour discussing the evidence that there was a high-level conspiracy to assassinate King and conceal the truth about it. Our guest is noted human rights lawyer, author, and King family friend, William Pepper. On this week's program, The Plot to Kill Martin Luther King, a conversation with William Pepper. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 6th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory, on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. A precipitous decline in household wealth, real wages, and quality of life is framed by the government and corporate media as prosperity and stability. This scenario is being challenged with the stark reality of rising racial and class tensions in the U.S. and the escalation of a war being carried out both domestically and abroad. Dr. King saw the situation clearly when, in 1966, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference took its campaign to Chicago and later Cleveland the following year. It is this aspect of the civil rights movement which is routinely overlooked by the establishment, which heaps false praise on the leader after he was brutally isolated and assassinated at the aegis of the racist state. Drawing the links between institutional racism, economic exploitation, and war is important in understanding the struggle of the 1960s and the present. That comes from the article, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., 50 Years Later, The Struggle Against Racism, War, and Poverty Continues, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted April 4th. The Americans couldn't win in Vietnam. With voices like that of MLK to contend with, the home front could not hold. Yet, it was several years before America finally withdrew its claws from the stricken country. And so it promises to be with Syria, where no serious commentator believes that Assad can be prevented from regaining control of his country, as Ho did with his. But still, America insists on prolonging the pain by attempting to colonize Syria's oil-rich Wild East, by forming new mercenary militias with tame tribes, by conducting relentless information and economic warfare. That comes from the article, Martin Luther King, Lesson for Today, Militarism and Economic Exploitation, Blatant Racism at Home and Imperialism Abroad, by Peter Ford, posted April 3rd, originally appearing at Beloved Syria. Despite the vastly more perilous state of our planet, many people and organizations around the world are following in the footsteps of Gandhi, King, and other nonviolent luminaries like Silo, and are engaged in what is effectively a last-ditch stand to end the violence and put humanity on a path to peace, justice, and sustainability. Let me tell you about some of these people and organizations and invite you to join them. In Bolivia, Nora Cobero works with the Movimiento Humanista. The movement has many programs, including the Convergence of Cultures, which aims to facilitate and stimulate true dialogue, oriented towards the search for common points present in the hearts of different peoples and individuals to promote the relationship between different cultures and to resist discrimination and violence. another program, World Without Wars and Violence, emerged in 1994 and was presented for the first time internationally in 1995 at the Open Meeting of Humanism held in Chile at the University of Santiago. That comes from the article, Nonviolence or Nonexistence, The Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. by Robert J. Burroughs, posted April 2nd. We should carefully reflect on MLK's message to the world. MLK understood the relationship between America's war agenda and social justice and civil rights in America. Quote, "No one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war, Vietnam," unquote. One cannot be a civil rights leader without taking a stance against U.S.-led wars. That was from a new introduction by Michelle Chosudovsky to a transcription of Beyond Vietnam, Silence is Betrayal, Martin Luther King's historic 1967 speech, posted April 4th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The official story of the assassination of civil rights leader Martin Luther King is as follows. Martin King had been staying at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, with his friend and colleague, Ralph Abernathy. On April 4, 1968, around 6:01 p.m. local time, a single bullet from a high-powered rifle shot him in the face and brought him down. An ambulance took him to St. Joseph's Hospital, where he was pronounced dead an hour later. The shooter was identified as one James Earl Ray, an escaped convict, apparently motivated by racism, who had taken the shot from the rooming house across the street from the Lorraine Motel. He then fled the scene and the country, but was captured in London's Heathrow Airport and extradited back to the United States. Ray pleaded guilty on the advice of his lawyer and was sentenced to a 99-year life sentence. This account has come under question. In fact, much of the public is generally unaware that there was a wrongful death civil trial almost 20 years ago in which members of the King family contested the official story. The trial conclusively found that James Earl Ray could not possibly have been the killer. On the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the King assassination, we'll be spending the hour discussing what really happened, why this truth has been concealed, and what this historic episode teaches us about the prospects for confronting power in our society, as King tried to do. Our guest is William Pepper. He is a barrister admitted to the bar in the United Kingdom and in jurisdictions throughout the United States. He was a friend of King's in the final year of his life. He came to believe that James Earl Ray was a fall guy in the murder of Martin King to cover up for the involvement of a broad conspiracy involving the Memphis Police Department, the FBI, and the local mafia. He represented the King family at the wrongful death civil trial and has written now three books on the King assassination: Orders to Kill, The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King; An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King; and his latest, from 2016, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. He joined us from New York City. We asked Dr. William Pepper to give us some background on how he came to be associated with Martin King.
I had been a journalist in Vietnam, and when I returned, I published an article in Ramparts magazine called The Children of Vietnam that dealt with American war crimes and some of the reality of the war. He was a subscriber to Ramparts, saw the piece, read the piece, was very distressed by it, and asked to meet with me. And so I met him and opened up more files to him, and he was devastated by what his government was doing. I then worked with him that last year of his life on the for the National Conference for New Politics. He asked me to run that. And we were looking to have a King Spock ticket, which was subverted at a convention in Labor Day weekend in Chicago.
You're talking about Dr. Benjamin Spock.
Yes, it was King and Spock, Benjamin Spock.
Okay.
That was the projection for the ticket. Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, the assassination was taking place. It took place on April 4th, 1968. And this would have been just right in the midst of the U.S. presidential primary season.
Yes, it was. It was. But we didn't have that third-party ticket because the convention with 5,000 delegates was subverted and disrupted by government agents who made it impossible to run that kind of ticket because they the attending Black Caucus, which were in small part but disruptive part, Blackstone Rangers, began to introduce anti-Semitic resolutions, which drove away all of the northern liberal Jewish money. So it cut the legs out from under that potential campaign.
Interesting. Now, when it came to the assassination, when you originally accepted the official story that James Earl Ray was the lone killer. You know, he had been in a rooming house across from the hotel where King had been staying, and or at least that's where he had had a room checked out. And, you know, that was the official line. He pled guilty in 1969 and was sentenced to 99 years. At what point did you start to doubt that official take on events?
Well, I began to doubt it when I interrogated Ray for 5 hours in August of 78. Abernathy wanted me to do that. He and I and Jim Lawson and a psychiatrist, a friend of mine, attended that interrogation at the Brushing Mountain Penitentiary in August, and Ray raised a number of issues and a number of facts that conflicted with the official story. And so I decided at that point to begin to look into it and see what I could find out for myself. And that's really when this 40-year investigation began, following the interrogation of Ray. I would go to see him periodically, and get questions and ask questions and try to get more information from him. And he kept asking me to represent him, and I refused to do so until 1988. It was 10 years after I met him, because I had to be certain that we all knew he was not the shooter. That was evident from the interrogation that I conducted in 78. But what we didn't know was what role he might have played in terms of the assassination. And it took 10 years for me to be convinced that he was an unknowing patsy.
Mm. Now, adjacent to this idea that he wasn't the shooter, there's the specter that there was a conspiracy involving a lot of different players that had conspired to kill King and put James Earl Ray in this patsy position. Did you come to this realization about the same time, or was there as you continued to interview James Earl Ray that the specter of a conspiracy started to come out?
Well, the more I dug into issues in Memphis, the more I became gradually convinced that this guy knew nothing about the plan, but was really just being set up to take the fall. And that became very clearly evident to me as I worked in Memphis.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about the man himself. He had actually been serving a prison sentence and then escaped, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you discovered at some point that there had actually he had had some help in escaping from the penitentiary where he had been detained, right?
Yes, that was arranged. Edgar Hoover sent $25,000 into Memphis with Clyde Tolson, his number two. And Tolson was always the intermediary, meeting with the Dixie Mafia people and government and police people who were involved in the assassination. With respect to Ray, they sent in $25,000 with Tolson. The head of the Dixie Mafia, Russell Atkins, took the $25,000 to the prison, gave it to the warden to pay him for arranging the escape. James knew nothing about it, but they had profiled him as an ideal candidate, Patsy candidate, and then they arranged for this escape. And then they kept him on a leash and knew where he was and kept him under control, moved him around to have him where he needed to be as a patsy. So I learned this because the 16-year-old son of the Dixie Mafia leader who went along with his father to give the money to the warden. So he was able to confirm that.
Mm. And over that period, so when he left, when he escaped, that was in 67, correct? Less than a year before the assassination. And what was he doing in that period between his escape and the time he had been given that access to that room at the rooming house?
Well, he was trying to get out of North America and trying very very hard to get into Africa, and so that was his goal. He started to head toward Canada, and he picked up a job, and he had a job in a restaurant for a period of time, and gathered a little bit of money. Then he went into Canada, and it was in Montreal that he met Raoul, who offered to help get him papers and get him out of the country and keep him out. But he asked him to do certain, he would have to do certain things for Raoul before that. And Raoul gave him money to buy a car and pretty much kept him on a string until they were ready to use him.
Mm. And there was a period where he was up in Canada, right?
Yes, this is in Montreal, where he met Raoul.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Raoul. He's a mysterious figure that that seems to be a very important player in this whole drama.
Well, he was the handler for James. He was a Portuguese immigrant. I believe he was involved with military intelligence in Africa for Portugal. He came to the United States and had certain connections both with organized crime and with the government. And he was involved in activities for the government, and he was the natural person they selected to take control and handle James, make sure that he was where they wanted him to be. So he played a significant, very significant role in the assassination. Yes.
Mm. Now I understand he ended up among the identities that James Earl Ray ended up adopting was one that would have given him a certain amount of protection in the event that some, you know, there was some intervention by the law enforcement that might have upset the plans to put him in that patsy role. Could you talk about that identity that he adopted?
James was given the identity of a man who worked in a weapons warehouse outside of Toronto in Canada. The identity was Eric S. Galt, G-A-L-T. They gave him that identity because if James was ever stopped for for speeding or anything else, that any police check would show that he had the special security clearance and he would be let go very, very easily. So that's why he was given the gold identity. There also was somewhat of a physical resemblance between Gault and James.
Now, what can you tell us about James Earl Ray's activities while he was in Memphis leading up to that fateful day, April 4th?
Well, he came into town as he was instructed by Raoul. He had bought a weapon, and he had turned it over to Raoul the night before on the outskirts of Memphis. Then he came into Memphis that day and parked the car in front of a rooming house as he was instructed. And he went upstairs, brought his belongings upstairs, and rented a room from Bessie Brewer, who ran the rooming house. And it was a room that had a window overlooking the Lorraine, but it was a small room, and he would not spend much time there because Raoul would tell him that he was meeting with some gun sellers, and he was needed privacy to meet with them to conduct purchases of weapons and things. But Ray was not in the room a great deal. But the room was used, so we learned, as a staging place for the shooting. And the shooter and his spotter went down and met Lloyd Jowers and Earl Clark in the bushes in the back of that rooming house.
Now, we know that James Earl Ray was nowhere near the crime scene when the assassination took place. What was he doing?
Yeah, that's right. He remembered that he had a flat spare tire. And that if Raoul took the car, as he thought he was going to, and had any problems with a flat tire, and there was a flat spare as well, he wouldn't be very happy. So James decided to go to a gas station and to some blocks away and to have that spare tire repaired. He was seen heading in that direction by two men who came out of Jim's Grill and who saw him driving toward that gas station. That evidence was buried deep in a file drawer and never referred to or used. When James was up at the gas station waiting, he heard sirens. They had begun already to send the ambulance down to the area where he was to meet. So he took off from the gas station, decided not to wait, and drove back toward the rooming house. But as he came up to the rooming house, he was waved away by the police, and he then just decided that he should make a break and head out of there and really go to Atlanta, where he was intended to go earlier at Raoul's suggestion. So he left the Memphis area and headed south to Georgia.
When did you get your first real lead as to who was involved in the assassination? Your first lead.
Well, I mean, it was evolving developments. I thought Earl Clark, who was a captain of the police department, was involved. He was a very good shooter on the police force and very, very, very much a racist. Turned out he wasn't. He was only acting as a spotter for the shooter, who was another policeman who was an excellent shot. Bits and pieces of information started to come from various witnesses all along. So it's not easy. When we ran a mock trial in 1993, our research and investigation produced results which led us in the direction of the Army being there. And they were there with an 8-man squad as backups. But they also had 2 photographers on the roof of the roof of the fire station. So it all developed gradually and was put together gradually.
Where did you first start to notice the involvement of Lloyd Jowers?
Well, Jowers was always a question because he owned the grill, which from back of which the shot took place, and he was always in the frame, but we never put him so directly in it as when he carried the smoking rifle into the back of the kitchen, broke it down, and took it out and put it on the shelf in the restaurant. Jowers. Secret was kept by Betty Spates from 1968 to 1994 when I was able to break her down and she told me the story of Lloyd and what she thought Lloyd had done.
Now, Lloyd Jowers, he was also he was a former police officer before becoming the proprietor of the Jim's Grill. He had made some connections with the local mafia, right?
Yes, he was very close to Frank Liberto, who hired him to do this job. Owed a lot of money to Liberto. That debt got forgiven, and he put $100,000 in an unused stove. He bought a taxi cab company after the assassination. So he was well in with them. His gambling debt was forgiven, and he was given quite a bit of money to cooperate.
Okay. So in terms of Lloyd's involvement in the assassination, could you comment a little bit more about what you've been able to piece together? That what he did in that critical couple of hours during and after the assassination.
Well, it's sort of difficult to provide all the details. We knew that James was the patsy. We knew that Jowers had involvement because he brought the smoking rifle in. Earl Clark, who was out there as a spotter, went down over the wall. He was seen by a taxi driver who was killed that evening. The shooter was a fellow named Frank Strouser, and Jowers was reluctant to name him, and we only got his name gradually over a period of time. From Lenny Curtis, who was a janitor at the rifle range, where he saw Strouser get the special rifle and practice with it all day before leaving around 3 p.m. This is what we know in terms of setting up the shooting that was taken from the bushes in the back area of the rooming house and Jim's Grill.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. In case you've just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. William Pepper. He is the human rights lawyer, most known for his defense of James Earl Ray in the trial of the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., and the author of three books, the most recent being The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. William Pepper, I'm wondering if we could also talk about the various ways in which the King delegation in Memphis had been somewhat set up. The fact that, for example, he had been asked to change or made to change rooms from a more secure area at the Lorraine Motel to one where he would be exposed on the balcony. Can you maybe provide us some insights as to how and why those, because that figures into the overall conspiracy too, right?
Yeah, the Dixie Mafia family, and in fact the wife of the leader of that family, received a phone call sometime shortly before the 4th of April, because King had only arrived there, and he was placed in room 202, which was a secure room. But she received a phone call and from her her son, who along with Frank Holloman was running the operation, the assassination operation, and she was asked to go to talk to one of the Adkins employees, was a black fellow called O.Z., and she was asked to call him, ask him to get to Jesse Jackson, and ask Jackson to go to the owner of the motel and move the room. Her son was there at the time that she took the call when she was making the arrangements, and she discussed it with him. So that the son was my informant of those events. Martin was moved to room 306,
mm-hmm.
where it was an open area and a clear target.
Yes.
And that's really what was required. When that happened, Mrs. Bailey, after the shot, Mrs. Bailey realized what she had done. She actually managed the motel. And she said, oh, my God, what have I done? She ran to her room and collapsed, had a cerebral hemorrhage, and was taken to the St. Joseph's Hospital, where she died about 5 days later. So the room change was organized by the conspirators and was thus carried out.
Okay. Now, there's also the fact that there's a major, you know, involvement on the part of, you know, other figures that would have acted as backup in case this sniper in the bushes had missed. Can you talk about how that was organized?
You're talking about the backup?
Yes.
Well,
the backup shooters.
The army had an 8-man team in Memphis as a backup unit. They were instructed at Cab. They came from Cab Shelby in Mississippi. And they were given their instructions, and they left around 4:30 in the morning. They were shown two photographs, one of Andy Young and one of Martin King. Those were the targets. They were told they were enemies of the state. They drove in and took up positions, one on the roof of the fire station, and we believe the other one on the water tower, each with a spotter, and they were waiting. If the shooter, the civilian shooter, did not do the job, they were prepared to do it. They were not going to let Martin King ever get to Memphis. He was too dangerous. from Memphis to Washington. He was too dangerous, and they were not going to allow that. Allow him to bring 500,000 people who could turn into a revolutionary mob. So they were determined to kill him one way or the other. They had the initial plan with Strausser as a civilian, quote civilian, he was always a police officer, shooter, and the army was backing him up in case he couldn't get the job done.
Some other details relating to the conspiracy, the fact that police that there had been some irregularities in terms of arranging for police to not be at or near the scene in the run up to the assassination.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me have that question again. Exactly what you want.
Okay. Well, I'm just wanting to clarify some other details that irregularities in terms of police being called off their normal rounds, in the lead up to the assassination on April 4th.
Well, that day, two black firemen at the local fire station were replaced. They were told to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. King's usual black bodyguard unit was kept in the police station. They were not involved. So they were taking all the necessary precautions to make sure that the effort would go off promptly and smoothly and without any eyewitness observations. They also had two photographers put on the roof. That was the military side of it. Two photographers put on the roof to shoot the back of the Lorraine Motel at the time of the shooting. One was to shoot up the balcony, the other was to shoot on the ground. And he was the one who brought his camera around into the bushes and actually caught the shooter lowering his rifle. The shooter, he said, who was not James Earl Ray.
There was also the issue of on the morning of April 5th, the next day, they had sent up a crew to clear the bushes near the grill from the location where some witnesses had seen the shooter. That also
They sent a cleanup crew in from the Public Works Department to clean up the entire back area, which was filled with high bushes and brush. And they cut all that down, and they cleaned it up thoroughly so that it would never appear that a shooter could be there without being spotted. So they took all of the brushes off, and even one tree limb, I think, was cut down. So they made it a safe haven for the shooter.
Mm.
And he then was able to escape, running back through the back of the building along the side of it, because it was a vacant lot along the side and out onto the sidewalk.
Mm. That was there any concern? I mean, the fact is, as I understand it, like the Memphis Police Department had ordered, sent out the orders to clean up that area, which was credibly accused crime scene. So that's an irregularity for which there was no official explanation, if I'm not mistaken.
No, there was no official explanation. There was no public knowledge that it was done. And they cut back a large intervening bush between the fire station and a vacant lot, because if that bush had been there, then their story of James having seen a police car and panicked and dropping the bundle in front of a store would have been, would have held true. Without that bush there, James could have seen the police car. But with the bush there, even if there was a police car, there was no way he could have seen it.
Now, going back to the assassination itself, the shot took place at 6:01. An ambulance came and took him to St. Joseph's Hospital. Now, could you maybe comment on that choice of hospital? Why King would have been taken there as opposed to another location?
Well, it was fairly close, but it wasn't as close as a couple of other hospital facilities. But, of course, they had to take him to St. Joseph's because that was, if it became necessary, that was where they were going to make sure that he didn't leave alive.
Uh-huh. Could you expand on that? What happened from what you've been able to determine, what happened from the time of the arrival at the hospital, St. Joseph Hospital, that evening?
Well, he was moved into the emergency room. Eventually, not immediately, but eventually they began to work on him, and they were trying to identify pieces of paper that had been dropped so that they could know their way out at the right time. But for the time being, they were ensconced in the hospital. Raoul was there as well with them. And it's important to know about Raoul was that he didn't have his passport with him, and yet he was on the list of the people who should leave the city as quickly as possible. So that was the escape area that they had left Frank Solomon and his crowd. Now, as you back out of here, you will tend to see Lara syndrome.
Okay, could you, there was an unusual, according to your book, there was an unusual number of military or intelligence people in the inside the hospital?
Yes, they got there early and they identified everybody. They knew every nurse and every doctor. They were very well informed and supposedly protective. Although they weren't being protective, they were effectively there to facilitate whatever Dr. Breen Bland wanted to do, and he was the one who took control of the room and control of the operation in the hospital. And he's the Adkins family doctor. He had been out with the Adkins family a couple of weeks before, and he insisted that they have that the group have a strong position with respect to covering up the assassination by Strausser.
Okay, so again, according to your book, Strausser, who you identified as the shooter, actually didn't kill King. That King appears to have, or the job was finished, you might say, inside that hospital. In his last moments alive, who was with King?
Well, Dr. Bland, they chased everyone out of the room. As they were going out, the last one leaving was the nurse, Shelby. She heard them gathering spit up in their mouths and had caught her attention as she was at the door going out. She then turned around, saw the three men, two in suits, and Dr. Bland. She saw the three of them spit on the body. That was when she saw Bland take a pillow and put the pillow over Dr. King's face and effectively suffocating him. The next morning when she went home at 11 o'clock, she called her family around and said, I don't know why they had to kill him. And then she told them the story. And it was years, years later, of course, that I deposed her, one of her sons, who knew the whole story from his mother, and who, under oath and video transcription, told us exactly what had happened to Dr. King. He was killed in the emergency room. He might have died anyway. He was badly injured by the bullet, but they were not taking any chances. There was no way that we're going to let him bring the mob into Washington. They were afraid it could turn into a revolutionary situation.
So a high-level conspiracy. There's a somewhat interest, yet another interesting aspect to this case, this idea that it wasn't just happenstance that King happened to be in Memphis, that he was somehow drawn there, that the sanitation workers' strike itself was bait for this trap of getting him to Memphis specifically. Could you comment on that?
Well, the sanitation workers' strike was the reason that he came to Memphis. That's true. The sanitation workers were determined to strike independently of Dr. King, but two of their members had been crushed on a rainy day in the back of the garbage truck where they went for shelter. They weren't allowed to go into regular shelters that other workers used in Memphis. And they were crushed in the back of the garbage truck by a man who was a member of of the Atkins group. That precipitated a great deal of anger, sympathy, compassion for the strikers, and Dr. King determined that he was going to go and do the best that he could on their behalf. He went to lead an a march which became disrupted and abortive, so he went back to Atlanta, decided to come again and do a work with one of the black radical groups to try to make it a peaceful march. And that black radical group, the Invaders, were also told to leave the hotel about 15 minutes before the assassination. They were dangerous. They could have seen something. They also were armed. So the plotters decided to get them out of there, and they were ordered out of the hotel.
Mm-hmm. There was just in the last few years, it's as I understand it, that you came across – this is since the civil trial that you represented on behalf of the King family. You came up with this new information that pointed you in the direction of this Frank Strausser, and this comes down to an individual whose identity you kept secret until he died. Could you tell us more about that last tidbit of information, which really helps complete the picture?
Well, Lenny Curtis is the man's name, and he was a janitor in the rifle range of the police department. And that's where Strausser and Clark used to work and hang out. He saw a special rifle come in and be given to Strausser. And he saw Strausser on the day of the assassination practicing all day with that rifle. And then he saw him leave around 3 o'clock. And Strausser had at various times said King was going to get his head blown off, that type of thing. So he was suspicious of Strausser. He also found that they were suspicious of him. And they kept him under surveillance, unmarked car outside of his house. excuse me. He was lighting a cigarette going into his house one day, and he smelled gas. He had to put the cigarette out. He saw a V sign in a tree above his, behind his kitchen window. And then finally, the final straw was Strauss asked him to come with him, ride with him downtown when he was going to pick up paychecks for the men. And on the way down, he didn't go the usual route. He went through a wooded area, and he showed his gun by brushing his coat back and asked Lenny who he thought, what he thought about Ray being the murderer of Dr. King. And Lenny quickly said, yes, of course he was. Everything points to him. He was, of course, speaking for preaching for his life. So down, they went down, they came back. But he had enough suspicion of Strauss from the background information and experience, and then the shooting and practicing of the rifle all day long. But I couldn't use, I deposed Lenny, put him under oath, and transcribed him and videotaped him. But we couldn't use that. We couldn't use that until he died, because I had no doubt that they would kill him. So we kept that as a part of our gathering information, but quietly held.
Mm. So, William Pepper, could you comment then on what makes this case so important in terms of helping us understand the ability of ordinary citizens to confront power in our society? What is the particular significance of this assassination and cover-up?
Well, because of the evidence we've uncovered, there's no question that this was a government operation. And it was an operation led by the FBI, by J. Edgar Hoover, using his number two, Tolson, and using the head of police and fire in Memphis, Frank Holloman, who used to work in Hoover's office and who, toward the end, became very involved in the detail of the assassination. So it was a government operation using a local Dixie Mafia people and a local hitman with strong government backup. So that we know. We know government can do that. Government did do that. What average citizens can do is really to try to pay attention to their government and what they're doing, what the officials are doing, and be as well informed as possible about that. And also, I think probably move to change the whole culture of this country from materialism and capitalism and militarism into something much more humane. And that would require really extensive work on amending the Constitution of the United States. And it's that's a task, but it's a task, that, in my view, that must be undertaken at some point in time. But an alert citizenry is essential for the salvation of a democracy. And unfortunately, in America, we don't have that alert citizenry yet. Hopefully, with cases like this coming to the foreground, we will be able to have it.
I have just one last question, because I know you got to go. But there has not been a lot of respectful media attention paid towards the case that you've put forward. Could you comment on why that is so?
Well, the corporate media in America, for the most part, does not want to cover cases like this. Corporate media is determined to keep the status quo and the credibility of governmental agents. You can imagine what the people would think if they knew that their government agencies were acting in this way, not only domestically, of course, but internationally, as they have been. So that's really the case. It's been a cover-up by the mainstream media, which is corporate controlled. There may be a breakthrough on that with the new Washington Post doing a major feature on this case, either coming out either on this Sunday or Monday. So one might look for it. But let me encourage people to try to get the copy of the book, The Plot to Kill King, anyway, because that's the one way to get the truth about this case. I put in every deposition, every piece of testimony that's of evidentiary value. It's all there in that one book. So any students of history are free to read it and revise this nation's history with respect to at least this case.
Well, Dr. William Pepper, I did have the great fortune 9 years ago of meeting and interviewing King's speechwriter, Vincent Harding, and I now can add to that, having had the opportunity to interview another key figure in his life, William Pepper. So thank you so much for agreeing to this interview, and I hope we can speak again at some point.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was William Pepper, human rights lawyer and author of 3 books on the assassination of Martin Luther King. William Pepper has also represented Sirhan Sirhan in the trial for the murder of Senator and 1968 presidential candidate Robert Kennedy, another instance believed to be a high-level conspiracy in which the official assassin is believed to be a patsy or scapegoat to conceal the conspiracy. William Pepper's website is williampepper.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour, podcast at globalresearch.ca and airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. Some of our content airs occasionally through Rabble Radio and can be found at rabble.ca. To leave feedback on our program, please email us at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. In a final commemoration to the death of one of America's most iconic civil rights heroes, we'll air a song by the legendary Nina Simone. The song was performed at the Westbury Music Festival on Long Island, New York, within days of Dr. King's assassination. Composed by Miss Simone's bass player, Gene Taylor, it's called Why the King of Love is Dead. The Global Research News Hour will return in 7 days. Thank you for joining us.
Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow man. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think this great man is dead.